Your child deserves an education that sets them up for success. K-12 knows that learning isn't one size fits all and has options tailored to each child's needs, interests, and goals for the future. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn at their speed, at home, from state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.
This week in Retronauts, we take David Bowie to the arcades and talk about the golden years. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Retronauts, episode 13. I am this week's ersatz host, Jeremy Parrish, and with me, as usual, we have...
I'm Ray Barnhold. Hello.
And the illustrious...
I'm Bob Mackey. I guess I'm illustrious now.
And the scintillating...
Samuel Claiborne.
See, I even got the
Alliteration.
I should be the bombastic Bob Mackey.
Yeah,
if you're going for Bob. That. Yeah. Ravishing Ray Barnhold.
I was going to say radical. Radical Ray Barnhold.
That's cool.
Yeah, thank you.
Anyway,
Sam is joining us. He's yes. from IGN. He does neat things.
Yeah, more importantly, I have 14 giant refrigerator-sized arcade games in my house. So,
how do you do that? Where
and
do you
no
live?
Refrigerator.
I've
really
worked
tragic.
Them into the house. You know, there's some in the living room.
And get this. He's married.
Jeremy's been there.
Yeah.
He's also the amazing thing is he lives in a normal San Francisco apartment with a wife. And yet, somehow, not only does he have a ton of arcade cabinets, he also has a pretty like roomy living room where he can just sort of chill and hang out.
Yeah, Sam's, we got lucky.
Sam's a masterpiece,
But seriously, I'm running out of room.
Yeah.
But if anybody out there has a mousetrap, I'll buy it from you. Cash right now. Actually, well, I'm going down the street backyard. After this. There's a couple of pinball machines. There's a Gorgar and a Middle
Gorgar.
Earth.
Gorgar, doesn't that talk?
Yeah, it's the first
Gorgar
talking
talk?
Game.
Okay,
it's
wow.
a
I've never
game.
Even heard of Gorgar.
Eugene Jarvis programmed the, nice. The voice in it. And you know, he did Defender and stuff, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But right down the street, there's a guy with a couple of pinball machines and old-timey arcade games that I'm going to go check out.
So when you walk into that arcade room, can you just feel the static electricity changing your DNA in some way when you're
I've
when
had
you're
a
in
fire
there?
Before.
Okay, that's another problem that could happen.
So yeah, even though this episode is coming to your ears in something like December or January, my God, I don't even know how far in advance this is.
The weather outside is frightful.
And this podcast will be delightful, but I'm a little jet lagged from having just returned from Tokyo Game Show. So if I'm delirious and don't make much sense, you might not notice any difference. But if it's worse than usual, it's because of jet lag. So I apologize for that. But anyway, just got back from Japan, where there used to be a lot of really cool arcades. And there really aren't anymore.
Yeah, I asked
sad.
You about that. You said there's no lasting old arcade games that you saw while you were there. Or
well,
ever, right?
In terms of cabinets, right. Yeah. All the Japanese arcades that you'll find that have retro games, which are a vanishing breed, by the way. Mm-hmm. They just shut down the really cool one in Shibuya called the Shibuya Game Kaikan, which was this arcade. It was like two floors. You could go, and it just had tons of old cabinets. Well, not old cabinets, but they're the generic cabinets.
The games and the kind of the
and
candy cabs.
They were 50 yen a piece, which is like half the price of a normal Japanese arcade game. But yeah, what they have is something called Astro City or other generic cabinets, where it's basically just like pretty much a MAME system. Mm-hmm. And
it might have a game board in it, but it's just hard to
a
find.
Lot of them don't.
Yeah,
you can
don't so.
Sometimes you'll
oh,
come
really?
Across them.
I mean, it begs
can,
the question,
you can see the,
where
like,
are all
the
Space Invaders
list.
That we heard so much about, you know?
I'm sure they were mulched and turned into building materials for, you know, the new Don Quixote or something.
That's sad. You know, the art in those games is all unique and stuff, too. We'll never
I
see
know.
Them.
Space Chewbacca and all
I
that.
Love a Japanese Donkey Kong machine.
That'd I really awesome. Can't think of any old vintage arcade cabinets that I've ever seen in Japan outside of the Pac-Man lobby at Namco's office.
That's true. Oh, really?
Yeah, they have a museum
there
of old
and I wanted to hear
arcade
about that.
Systems.
Okay, cool.
You really have to, I guess, go to the ends of the earth, so to speak.
Right.
Japan.
Yeah, I mean, go
I'm
to
sure
like,
there's a collector there.
Go to like know, Hokkaido to some convenience store that no one's been to in the past 30 years.
Yeah, they probably have a Space Invaders.
Right, yeah. Or probably not something you want to play. It's like, I don't know, a beaten up copy of Ikaru.
Well, I'll tell you, America has plenty of space and plenty of arcade games still. It's lousy with them. It's good. They're still around.
But, you know, despite the fact that they don't have vintage cabinets, they do, you know, still have a fair handful of arcades where you just play retro games. There's one in Akihabara that I went to for the first time this year, and It's like three floors of different kinds of vintage games. There's like one floor that's just shooters, one floor that's more like, you know, Golden Age arcade games. Mm-hmm. It's that, you know, that was kind
of
cool.
As you all know, the emulations of arcade games can be very, very different from the original experience.
That is true. But a lot of these games are so obscure that, like, I don't even know what the difference would be.
It's not Atari Star Wars or anything.
I saw Outfoxies for the first time.
Outfoxies? That sounds great.
It's basically Smash Brothers before there was Smash Brothers. Was that a Sega game, Ray?
No, it's Namco.
Namco? Okay.
Is it Sprite Art?
Yeah, it's Sprite Art. It's from like 1995, and it's like this one screen, like a big sort of stage area, and it scrolls in and out, and up to four players can run around, and there's like a character with a whip.
It zooms?
It zooms in and out,
With Sprite Art.
Yeah, it's like, you know, super scaler type stuff.
It's like that Castlevania XBLA game.
Yeah, it's a lot like that.
Oh,
actually.
Yeah, totally, yeah.
But it's, you know, kind of a Smash Brothers where four people are just going at it in a free-for-all and trying to knock each other off the stage and that sort of thing.
Yep.
It was
foxes? I mean,
they're not foxes.
Oh.
The lady with the whip is a little foxy.
Oh. Okay.
But that's about as close as it gets.
Okay.
So yeah, you'll find stuff like that and Edward Randy and just, you know, totally random stuff in these arcades and, you know, stuff that you've never seen in real life. So it's kind of cool.
That is cool.
But we're not talking about that. We're talking about the golden age of the American arcade, which was here, not there, and also 30 years ago, not now.
And very specifically here. I mean, the Bay Area was where arcade machines came from. They were manufactured in Milpitas.
I didn't live in the Bay Area, but I still played a lot of video games in the early 80s. It was not some unique culture to California. So
No, I'm just saying don't you be getting physically manufactured. I'm not from California either. But I've been to the Atari headquarters building in Milpitas. I made a pilgrimage.
Well,
it's unremarkable being an empty office building.
Is it covered in vines? Is it kudzu? Is there lots of overgrowth?
There's just like piles of arcade machines in the back. Yeah, just ice. Which cream. One do you want to take, honey?
The last pack of cigarettes Jack Tramiel ever smoked?
Actually, from what I've read, a lot of machines were manufactured here, Atari's machines. But, you know, there was a big arcade distribution network on the East Coast, Chicago. Yeah. Well, it's not East Coast, but also New Jersey. So you kind of had games coming from both directions and then sort of pooling down into the middle of the country where I lived. So
distribution problems. In the golden age of arcades, there were arcade machines in airports. They were in every corner store. They were in high school
laundromats.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Any place where you could have change.
Yeah, it's basically amazing. I mean, I remember going to drugstores. And there would be just an arcade machine in sort of the entry room, like the mud room where you come in and you wipe your feet before you go into the store.
Oh, yeah,
yeah, that's
there
right.
Was just like,
yeah.
There'd be a video game just kind of tucked there because it was empty space. And hey, we can turn that empty space into a profit generating video game revenue.
They still do that. They'll have the kids plane thing where you get on a plane and it shakes your kid.
And all
know?
The quarter but, machines.
Imagine that being Galaxian.
Right, yeah.
So I mean, cool.
Yeah. They still use that space for that kind of stuff, but video games were very, very pervasive in the early 80s. It was kind of an awesome time to be a child.
Yeah, I saw there was an article with a bunch of pictures of BART in San Francisco, our subway system here, with giant 70s Atari consoles in it. Like they weren't
in
weren't
the trains
actual,
or in the station?
They're in the station, on the platform. And I think this picture was of, it might have been Powell Street, and I think it was, and it was they had Atari had made these kind of columns that looked like Death Star spaceship design columns, and each one had like, you know, key games and Atari games in it, like Tank and
I saw those
really
pictures
cool.
too. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
It looks that's fantastic. And the people,
was that just
that
like a temporary
clothes.
Installation, or was that something that?
Yeah, it's like a marketing type of thing.
You think so? It. You think it was marketing?
Well,
I mean, I think they're making money.
Look how cool video games are.
Yeah, it's beautiful though. It looks really neat. I mean, those stations are already. It wasn't a different station because it looked like totally like, you know, some of the stations are brutalist. I think it was probably in Embarcadero because the whole thing it looked like it looks
all at an angle.
Yeah, yeah. Everything
has
cement and
architecture.
Yeah, and like weird ribbed cement stuff. And then, like, you know,
well, BART already looks like BART already looks like a spaceship from the 70s,
yeah,
or at least
exactly.
a 70s sci-fi utopia.
So add Pong to that, and it's like the greatest place on Earth for me.
Does BART look like Star Tours? This is getting too local, but I just always get that impression when I walk on it. I always think of Star Tours.
Yeah.
Anybody?
The trains? People mover?
The trains themselves. I just remember
Star
Tours.
Yeah, well, that's because those things haven't been updated since, like, 1965.
Yeah, I just want to know if they got the same mold, maybe, for Star Tours.
Could be.
You know, nothing
this week on Retro Trains.
There's an off-brand Star Wars droid riding the train.
That was back when BART was fairly new.
So yeah, the late 70s.
Yeah, it must have been pretty nice having that. sort of space age convergence, right. Let's say.
And they're just changing the seats.
For a moment, San Francisco today. Felt yes. like the future.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Sorry, this is getting too obscure.
No, but we're talking about that is just the pervasiveness of arcade games mm-hmm. was just amazing. And, you know, we'll never be that again, you know?
No. Now they're in so our much pockets, smaller. Which just isn't the same.
No, it's not.
Ships and there's more on the way. I'm a space cadet. I can really play hyperspace. Push on the button and I'm back in the race. Hyperspace.
I don't even know where to start with this because classic video games, arcade games, is such a huge topic. We might have bitten off more than we can chew.
Sure.
I don't know.
Well, then it wouldn't be Retronauts.
That's true. But, you know, I put down a list of key titles, but it'd be really boring to just kind of go through these in chronological order. Obviously, arcades really and truly, the video arcade starts with Pong. I mean, there were a couple of arcade video games before that, but
at the time, that was kind of recognized to be a bar game, too. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. You know, they were in bars and laundromats and stuff. And there were arcades, though. There was plenty of pinball arcades and stuff like that.
So, yeah, I mean, we'll talk about that in the next week's pocket episode.
Old-timey games. Right.
Like, but, I'm aware of midways and, you know, areas like that, but what were in arcades before arcade games? Did they exist? I know pinball was a thing. I just didn't know if there was a room, existed. You know.
We'll talk about that next time.
God damn it.
What we should talk about is really how that sort of transformed from electromechanical games and into video games where everything had a television.
And Pong was, you know, the concept of Pong was to make money in the way that a pinball machine makes money, right? It takes quarters and gives you a short experience. There's a couple remarkable things about it. One being that it's a co-op game. The most popular early arcade game took two people. You can't play it alone. You can play it alone, but you can just bounce the ball back and forth. You can get the ball stuck, too, and get it bouncing back and forth.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
That's when you get another drink, right?
Yeah, it's exactly. Like you can the do trick. That. Scott Bromley is really good at that from the Comedy Button. I've seen him do it multiple times on my Pong machine.
It's definitely a marketable talent.
So it's because of that, they had, you know, pinball parts and a new way to print a game on a circuit board with no ROM or anything like that. But if you open up a Pong machine, it has a TV inside, like a plastic full completed television with an antenna like bent down on it.
Sure.
It has a bread pan for the quarter catcher, like. You just get it from Sears, a bread pan. And then the only other thing in there is the game board and the quarter slot, which is from a laundromat.
Right. Well, that the bread pan explains why Sears was so eager to get home Pong. They were like, well, you're already buying our components. Let's just get some synergy going on here.
Yeah. And so, of course, there's that original myth from Andy Capps where I call it a myth, but, you know, where the Pong machine was crammed with quarters and you know, you couldn't operate it anymore. And they said, oh, it's going to be a hit. But if you look inside even that half Pong machine, I'm sure there's plenty of room for quarters in it.
Yeah,
that's kind of the Carney Nolan Bushnell.
I would say it's more
thing.
An urban legend than a myth.
Well, I think Nolan Bushnell would tell that and say, like, this is, you know, this is what it's all about.
Oh, so it's marketing, basically.
It's marketing. And he had speaking of carnivals and stuff, he had a carnival background. I mean, he worked as a carny. He set up ring tosses.
Who would have thought?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at a lot of industries, you know, a lot of creative industries, it's all well and good to have creative geniuses and really talented, imaginative people like Shigeru Miyamoto making video games, but you need self-promoting, self-aggrandizing assholes to get things out there. And Nolan Bushnell, Steve Jobs, Hiroshi Yamauchi, like those were dudes who didn't make any friends and went out and did kind of nasty things. And, you know, it's as much because of them as because of the creatives that video games became as popular and pervasive as they were. And Nolan Bushnell definitely has a pretty sour reputation in a lot of quarters. You know, you compare him to Ralph Baer, who probably has a better claim on being the father of video games. Mm-hmm. And Bushnell, I think, made a lot more money and became a lot more influential, got a lot more fame for his name than Baer. And, you know, that's just the nature of the thing. There's the creative aspect of video games and the business aspect. And especially in the days of the arcade, the business aspect was really important because, you know, video games sort of inserted themselves into this existing distribution network of coin-op machines, of, you know, pinball games and electromechanical games and jukeboxes and Wurlitzers and yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, you can see at the time, too, that the conquest for quarters was actually bad for games early on, because what did everybody do when they saw Pong? They made a Pong clone. There was no innovation at all. And to quell innovation and competition, Nolan Bushnell started another game company called Key Games with Joe Keenan, and just made his own Pong clones. And then they didn't tell anybody that. And people they had competing, you know, supply chains.
Yeah, we talked about that actually the last episode that I hosted, which was about Atari. And, you know, he kind of used that as a way to play the market against itself and get these two separate distribution chains combined, because they were, you know, both Atari and Key were making these really hot games, and there were two separate distribution systems basically in place for coin-op machines. And both of them sort of wanted the games that were exclusive to the other distributors. So they were like, well, how can we get these, you know, over in our system? So Nolan Bushnell proposed, well, why don't we merge Atari with Key, and one company and will buy the other?
Tank, which became Combat eventually, which is a cool game. But that wasn't a bouncing ball game. And you can see, like, everybody probably flipped out.
Well, Combat
because
has,
it wasn't.
Like,
there's only so many ways you can
bouncing
bounce
around.
That's true. That's the same programming, too, to use those balls to bounce around, obviously.
Yeah, doesn't surprise me.
That was built into the Atari VCS, too.
That was the first Havoc physics engine.
Yes.
Oh, man.
Ragdolls.
So, I mean, at the time, though, you know, throughout the entire 70s, there were space games, driving games, you know, a few shooters before Space Invaders, and then Pong games. But games where you bounce a ball. You know, that was the entire market.
Well,
they were popular.
There were racing games. I don't think you mentioned those.
No,
did you?
So, yeah,
okay.
I didn't. And
they
were cool, too.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, there was, what was it? Was
Sprint
it,
and
was it Indy 8 that had the mirrors above the system so you could watch, like, eight people could
that
play.
That was the 8-player one.
And then you could have a crowd around because
It
was so amazing
that
they just knew people would want to watch people racing against each other. These little black and white cars
screen. This is the top down, like, what is the Iron Man Stewart?
Super off-road.
It's kind of the same idea as that, or Sprint.
I mean,
you know, you're just
RC Pro, and I'm like, Yeah, I mean, if you look,
it's
like,
black and white,
there weren't that many different genres represented in the 70s, but kind of a lot of the basics were laid down. Like you said, you know, you had Pong, you had sports, you had racing.
Atari football was around then.
Yeah.
I mean, it definitely, like, by the end of the 70s, things exploded, though, because there was already the Atari 2600, and people could make games, you know, that represented all sorts of different things in real life. And it just wasn't like that in the early 70s, though. You know, computer space didn't take off. They didn't make a bunch of, you know, spaceship games based on that. They made a bunch of games based on Pong.
Right, because Pong was a lot more accessible.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have to understand physics and inertia to be able to play Pong. You just had to know that you wanted to avoid missing the ball for the high score.
The rule.
In the 70s, I would say, I don't know, maybe, what would you say are, like, the five most important games designed in the 70s?
Gosh. Ooh. Space Invaders, Pong, Asteroids. I mean, that came out
in Galaxian
80.
78 or
Galaxian
something.
Galaxian 78.
That's the first color game.
Yeah,
and it's beautiful too.
Like real color generated by the machine on the screen, as opposed to like a
That was 78
light overlay.
That was 78?
79.
That was 79. So 1 year after Space Invaders.
Right.
Okay.
Well, I mean, Space Invaders kind of, you know, that was the next Pong. It started this boom of games that were pretty much the same thing, but with slightly different details. And
you have to mention the first kind of vector games. I think Night Driver was one of the first ones from Cinematronics.
Mm, yep.
And that was, you know, just a blank road that was drawn with, you know, math, essentially, in vector. And it's really cool.
Was it even vector? I thought it was just like sprites.
It's vector.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah. Mm,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I mean, going back to Space Invaders or Galaxian, I think it was on an episode, like a really early episode of Game Center CX, where Arno interviewed Nishi Kaido, the creator of Space Invaders, and said, like, are there any games that, you know, you think really improved on Space Invaders? And he was like, well, you know, everyone just kind of ripped off what I did, but Galaxian was really cool because it had color and it did all these things that I wanted to do but couldn't do. So, yeah, you start to see this sort of progression.
Yeah, it had the ships that flew down. It's beautiful, too. That starfield in the background is just remarkable looking. When you've seen a bunch of black and white games your whole life.
Yep. Yeah, I think Galaga, the sequel, is a lot more fun. Yep. But I can't imagine the impact that Galaxian had at the time. It must have been pretty profound to be able to see
this
real color in there.
To the people playing it, had color. You know, it had these color gels over the black and white monitor.
Yeah.
And people remember that.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, yeah. You definitely got that sense of color, but there is something different when you have pieces of color moving freely around the screen. It's not just restricted by zone. And, you know, the fact that the ships could break formation, which the invaders couldn't do, I mean, that made a huge impact. And if you look at a lot of the Space Invader sequels and things like Cosmo Gang the Video, really kind of there's a lot of back and forth with the Galaxian Galaga series.
Mm-hmm.
So those were kind of, you know, neck and neck at the time.
It was unusual to have a Japanese designed game still in, you know, in the Space Invaders era. So, you know, Space Invaders was, of course, by Taito, and you know, but they covered that up. You know, like Midway licensed, Midway licensed both those games here.
Yeah, Galaxian, I don't know that it was necessarily meant to be a cover up. I think it was just, you know, the companies wanted to put their own names on it, so people would associate Space Invaders with Midway.
I've always suspected there was some negativity about Japanese imports.
I'm sure there was. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
but it could have also been that
I never knew that Nintendo was a Japanese company when I was a kid.
Weird.
It's strange.
I guess. Yeah. It was like a kind of a dirty secret, but not really. But
yeah,
I would
see television shows like the ones you promoted, where people were like, "Nintendo, the Japanese panic is Japan taking over your living room," and I was really confused. Maybe. I was like, "What's about Japan?"
It could have also been that like Taito and other companies didn't really want to go all in with an American branch yet. It could have just been easier to license, you know, for as much as they knew.
Yeah, by far. I mean, look at what happened to Nintendo. They nearly bankrupted themselves by trying to do their own distribution in America. And, you know, if Donkey Kong hadn't turned out as well as it did, Nintendo wouldn't be around anymore, because the cost and delays of shipping a few thousand copies of, what was it, Radar Scope overseas to distribute in America. Like, by the time the games got here, no one cared about that game anymore. And so they were stuck with thousands of useless units.
Hmm.
Like, it made much more sense for a company like Taito or Sega to, you know, to license in with Midway or Bally or Williams or whoever, and let them deal with the manufacturing and distribution in America. So I don't know that it was necessarily a cover-up. But yeah, I mean, there was some weirdness around Japanese imports at the time, and
Japan?
Yeah.
Who would have thunk
it? I feel like the Japan panic was more a product of the mid to late 80s. Like, that's when Japan really had its super booming economy and started buying up all kinds of properties and making investments in America.
That's when John Hughes cashed in on that sentiment. A little bit.
With Long Duk Dong.
Long Duk Dong, yeah.
But that's like a Chinese name.
It's a mix of many Asian stereotypes.
Except Getty Watanabe is a Japanese.
He's Japanese,
actor, so
but it's like,
confusing.
Yeah, it's very. He didn't do his research on stereotypes. I mean, come on.
Damn it, John Hughes.
R.I.P. Maybe.
Maybe.
It's good.
R.I.P.
So what is your first arcade memory, Sam?
I didn't experience arcades firsthand until Street Fighter. You know, I
seriously?
Didn't have that. Yeah, I have no nostalgia for these games. I just think they're amazing.
I thought you were like 45.
No, I just turned 32.
Oh,
so I was born in 81.
You're all just kids. You're babies.
Yeah, well, I mean, and like I do remember, you know, those games being the old games in the corner of the arcade. But unfortunately, I wasn't able to experience this stuff. But I lived through, you know, books and photos of the era vicariously. I love that stuff. You know?
But I mean, you're like 5 years younger than me, so I'm actually surprised you don't have arcade memories earlier than that.
So I remember going to Aladdin's Castle in Iowa City, where I'm from, and in the old Capitol Mall, and they had a Play Choice machine. I remember that.
Mm-hmm.
I remember playing Super Mario Brothers 3, and everybody's like, "Oh, this is in this. You can't get it in stores. You couldn't get it in stores easily, or maybe it wasn't out yet." And people were just talking about it.
Yeah.
I do have that, and that would have been, you know, 88, 89 too. So. Even though that game came out in 90, it was in PlayChoice.
Right. No, I remember. We actually, in the last episode that I recorded, which was in Tokyo, we talked about that and about, you know, sort of the impact of seeing Super Mario Brothers 3,
mm-hmm.
Like, you know, before anyone else could play it, before you could buy it at home, and how, like, people would just flock to that PlayChoice machine because, whoa, Super Mario Brothers, it's like a movie. It's like The Wizard, but here in my arcade. It's amazing. Bob, Ray, what are your earliest arcade memories?
Well, I mean, strangely, I guess it makes sense for how old I am. I'm 31. I sort of got into the arcade during its first like pre-Street Fighter death, before Street Fighter sort of bolstered things for another few years. But yeah, there was an arcade in my mall called Fun Games. Fun, the letter Fun. N, games.
Fun Games.
And then there was another one out in a plaza somewhere down the street from the mall called Fun and Pizza, which is all you need to survive.
Now,
maybe
would,
some water.
I would have merged them and made Pizza and Games. And oh, just yeah, leave yeah. out the fun.
The fun is inherent in that. But
it's
I mean,
your family crash, right, Bob?
Yeah. Forget the blackjack.
But yeah, I mean, I was too young for the golden age of the arcade, but I mean, those machines were still around when I was a kid. But obviously, the machines of the late 80s, early 90s were more impressive and the ones I flocked to more often. So yeah, I mean, there were always arcades around until around maybe 1997, and that's when the mall arcade closed, and shortly after Fun and Pizza closed, and I miss it. I miss it because I had my 10th birthday party there, and that place has still, no one has moved in yet since the arcade was gone.
Wow.
That's like any small town in America, yeah. Like, you know, businesses are flocking to it.
All this retail space that no one wants.
Some right. say the old arcade is haunted.
Old man Carruthers.
You know, I feel like the late 80s is kind of this underappreciated period of arcade games. I mean, that's not what we're talking about this time. But yeah, I mean, like you had all those really, really cool, fun, innovative games from Atari games. You had all kinds of crazy...
Desperately innovative.
Well, I mean, stuff like, like Rampart, Gauntlet. Like the stuff that, you know, was really, really unique. And then you had stuff coming out of Japan, like, you know, the crazy three monitor games from Taito, like Ninja Crusader, Ninja Warriors, which was it?
The Ninja Warriors?
Ninja Warriors. Yeah,
and Brawlers really hit.
Yeah,
that,
Brawlers, right? for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I put a lot of quarters into those, too.
So the first arcade game I remember playing was Miss Pac-Man in a grocery store.
Nice.
Right by the entrance exit of a Safeway. The nearby Safeway. And that was in like, 88, 89. I can't remember if it was before or after I actually got an NES. But then, like a year or two later, the big mall opened in town and that had a Tilt arcade in it. And that was, you know, that was the place to go for a while. And that stuck around quite a while. I think it was in the mall for years and years, more than 10 for sure. And it may still be there. I don't know. But yeah, that was in my hometown and that was like, one of my earliest exposures to video games was that Miss Pac-Man in the grocery store.
And we've all been exposed to these old games now because there's conventions and, you know, right. people own them and stuff. And,
right.
and I remember like really getting into retro arcade games from bars, you know, like I knew a bar that had a Cocktail Centipede and it was so fun. You know, you just go get cocktails and play Centipede. And then they switched that up for Donkey Kong, then Miss Pac-Man. Like I've really started getting obsessed with games at that point, old games.
When I'd be driven to school, high school sometimes in the mornings, we'd always drive by this house that had a Donkey Kong machine in the front yard. Just,
ouch.
Just a junked old thing being just totally mistreated.
Oh, no.
And I'd always go by, it's like, oh, man, if only. What could have been? I could have had that Donkey Kong.
Just covered in snow.
Yeah, geez. All year round.
Man, I feel a little old. I'm the only one here who actually saw arcades sort of in their prime. Which, I don't know, I feel like that's a special gift.
I'm sorry.
Given just to
if my mom was negligent enough to have left me, like, sitting on an Asteroids machine, you right. know, I could have absorbed it through osmosis
I'm
or something.
I'm sure we strolled by some when we were born.
Sort of, like, reached at it with our infant hands.
There was a sort of universal appeal to the sort of golden age arcade games in the early 80s that allowed them to just kind of appear en masse in places, you know, like... Things like Chuck E. Cheese and Showbiz Pizza sprung up in the early 80s.
Pizza Time Theater.
Exactly. So you get your pizza in games. Even if it wasn't called that, that's what it was. It was really bad pizza.
Creepy robots.
That your parents would sit and suffer through because they loved you. And then just, you know, this orgiastic playland of video game machines.
Part of the reason that we don't have arcade memories, even though we were conscious and could go play games, is that a lot of places actual arcades were places where teenagers smoked, and it was kind of scary.
Yeah.
And I remember being really intimidated even in when I was 10 going to see Street Fighter
right.
you know, being played. I wouldn't even play. I was too scared to play
with
the kids.
You know, I never actually went to standalone arcades.
Right.
I always went to the arcades that were either like a putt-putt or in a pizza place
sure.
or in the mall.
Right.
And, you know, like those were a lot safer. By that point, they'd started to phase out smoking in malls.
Mm-hmm.
There was the Smoker's Haven store where you could like go and smoke a pipe. But that was pretty much it. Like
it's like those sad cages at the airport where all the smokers sit in misery.
Yeah, you wouldn't believe, like, in restoring old games, like, every control panel I've ever gotten has a cigarette burn on it. And they're just like, somebody just sitting there just playing, you know, Galaxian all night long, just gets burned.
I don't know. I feel like maybe it was just where I lived, but there were a lot of options for playing arcade games that didn't involve rowdy teenagers smoking and sharing their heroin needles or whatever.
Even outside of the arcade in the mall, there'd like be these little like groups of six arcades machines back to back, you know, just in the middle of the mall. No one was running them. I don't know who was operating them or collecting the money, but there were like these little mini arcades throughout the mall too. When I was growing up.
Yeah, so, and you know, that means that we were exposed to kind of the more popular games, but, you know, the cool thing that I'm learning now and researching and playing old games is that, you know, less popular games that we don't know about as much now were just so good. And there's games like Mr. Do and stuff like that. I would have never run into that myself, you know.
So defend like, Mr. Do for me, because that's always struck me as really just a like big ass ripoff of Dig Dug.
Really?
Is it not?
No, not at all. I think Mr. Do has a lot of cool. I don't like Dig Dug. I think Dig Dug's kind of dull. So it has great music.
You can squish Fygars.
Yeah, you can. I think Mr. Do is. There's several ways to score. You know, that are different. You know, you can either collect the cherries, which you're not supposed to do, or you can do these like complex crushing.
Wait, what happens if you do collect the cherries?
It goes do 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 do, and then you don't get as many points as you would by killing all
so
the enemies.
So you enjoy music? And
no, I'm saying
penalized.
That's terrible. Yes, exactly. No, it's just that you can clear the board by doing this one thing, which is collecting everything, or you can do it by killing enemies, and you want to do it by killing enemies, and then you can spell stuff. And I don't know, it's a cool.
Video games were murder sims even in the 80s.
I'm a Mr. Do's castle man myself, so I'm not going to defend it too much.
How does a clown have a castle? What's going on?
With Mario a giant has a castle.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, I think in video games, if you want a castle, you just have a castle.
That ain't Mario's castle.
Sounds like a French fable.
Mario lives in the sewers.
He has a castle in the sewers.
Yuck.
It's sort of the opposite of Castle in the Sky. It's like
anti-Miyazaki
movie. Yeah. No, you see where he lives in Paper Mario games.
And Mario,
he's just
Mario
got like
RPG.
a little cottage.
He does.
Luigi, yeah, okay. They have a bunk bed.
Like Link and his uncle.
Mm-hmm, pretty okay. much. Except
just one bed.
Luigi doesn't die at the beginning of the game. Peach is your ...
Spoilers, he lives. Watch the ending, kids.
It's the year of Luigi. Of course he's got to live.
Oh, I meant as Link's uncle.
Oh, yeah. Right.
He inexplicably lives. I don't know what happened to his body. But
it's a retcon.
Yeah, I guess
Nano
so.
Machines.
Happy endings all around.
I don't know about that. We were naming the greatest games of the 70s. I think we said Pong, Space Invaders, Galaxian.
Yeah.
I was going to throw in a Vector Run. I think maybe instead of Night Driver, Lunar Lander would be a good vector-based game, and
yeah,
it's really
that's a good
cool.
call. What about Breakout?
Yeah, Breakout's really, really important.
Breakout is the game that made the Macintosh, or no, the Apple II what it was.
Mm-hmm. Steve Jobs was Atari's 40th employee. He worked with the Woz on Breakout.
Yep.
But they were told to make that game. They didn't like come up with it. They just had
No. What I'm talking about is with the Apple II. When Wozniak was building the hardware for that, he specifically built color capabilities into the computer hardware so that he could play Breakout.
That's great.
Rainbows everywhere. Yep.
Yeah, I mean, the system would have been just, you know, another black and white computer, but
you could have put
Wozniak was like,
tape
no,
over it
my gym, my precious gym, I got screwed over by Steve on this.
Breakout is a black and white game in arcades. It has
well, it's
color
like fancy
well.
Breakout, Super Breakout,
yeah,
I guess.
It is.
Right, yeah.
Arkanoid is what that's called.
No, there was a Super Breakout, sir.
Yeah.
I think one of the driving forces of the original IBM PC was also the fact that they wanted to have it play a competent Pac-Man port.
It didn't.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Well, I mean, originally, like the original engineers, there's a tiny 30-minute Harold Morris piece with a bunch of different IBM innovators, and they talked to the IBM PC people. One of the guys is like, hey, we just wanted to play Pac-Man.
Other 70s games, a video pinball was really interesting. It was Atari's video pinball. It was like, it used a reflection setup. It's an upright.
And thus a line in the sand was drawn.
Yeah, it's really cool. And was Warrior in the... In the 70s, it's an old vector game, but it might have been 1980.
I don't know. Wasn't that Pat Benatar?
I mean, that game was a fighting game based on vector graphics. You know, it was two people fighting
Damn,
each other.
I've never played that. That sounds...
It's really cool.
Probably
it's
not very
down,
fun,
but
really cool. Oh, kind of like the
knights.
Atari boxing?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or the Death Star, the lightsaber arena game.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, it's a straight up, you know, fighting game. We just go up and whack each other a lot. It's really funny.
Mm-hmm. Are there like Hadoukens and stuff?
No, it's just swords.
Disappointing. Disappointing.
Warriors don't use Hadoukens.
So like, are you calling Ryu not a warrior? He's a world warrior,
he
sir.
He is a world warrior. Well, yeah. We're all world warriors in Street Fighter.
You know, several weeks ago when we were talking about arcade games, I was saying, like, you know, those earliest driving games were kind of important. And we were just talking about, like, those original ones as well.
Yeah, especially...
The top-down racing games. And, yeah.
Was Grand Track 10 the first racing game?
I don't... Well...
Death Race.
The first
good
racing game?
I was going to say... Well, I don't know if what was the first one, but Grand they Tech used ROM.
Track 10 was 1974, so that's just 2 years damn after long.
That was Sprint, a Key Games one?
Sprint came before Sprint, I believe.
I have foggy. Sprint here as 1976, actually.
Hmm. All right, whatever.
But to Bob's point, Death Race was definitely the coolest and the first controversial.
There was no real racing to be had, though. It was just Death Run Over People 2000.
This is almost Robert, you're doing a Retronauts retrospective here.
Yeah, it's like, remember that episode a few episodes ago?
Yeah, sure.
Did you guys talk about Death Race?
We did.
It was the first controversial game.
We're just re-mining our old material.
Did you talk about how it would make like the coolest t-shirt ever? The art from Death Race?
I love the cabinet art. It's cool.
They have that at the Museum of Technique.
So. I played it there. Yeah.
Yeah. The side is like this crazy. And side art, you know, started really taking off by the late 70s. And that game is just decorated.
Man, floor to ceiling. So my favorite t-shirt when I was about 7 years old was a Centipede cabinet art t-shirt. It was like the Centipede cabinet art. But it was like one of those iron-on transfers, and it was kind of sparkly.
Yeah,
which was amazing. And then it had it was a Ringer shirt, so it had like it was dark blue, and then it had dark green sleeves with like dark blue stripes on it.
Dude,
I love that shirt so much.
We're talking about cabinet art. I hate to jump forward to the 80s, but Nintendo's cabinet art was always the best for me. And I wish the characters still looked like that, like little squat with like really thick black lines,
right, and their teeth were like little crosses.
Yeah, like Donkey Kong, Mario, Luigi, the weird
like
teeth.
Like the Zelda manual. Like I wish Link looked like that.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Cute. I mean, do you guys know who did that art?
I'm pretty sure it was Miyamoto. Like, that looks like Miyamoto's style from what I've seen of his drawings.
And it's not.
I think it was they like took his art and then you know
they had anime guys. Do like touch-ups on Punch-Out people and things like that. So really? I imagine that, but it's weird that it isn't really dated. When I look at that art, it looks like it could be contemporary just because of...
But I mean, you know, Miyamoto got to start at Nintendo as an artist, not as a game designer.
Yeah.
So like having seen his artwork and like looking at that art and knowing his history there, I'm assuming that he did a lot of the original designs for their cabinet art, which, you know, would make a lot of sense.
Yeah, I mean, Popeye's is amazing looking, but, you know, that's based on existing designs. But Donkey Kong kind of looks like Popeye because it's supposed to. So.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, the art they used was like a very flat cartoon style. They didn't go in for a lot of the, like, crazy funky effects or airbrushing and all that. It was just, like, classic, you know, Disney-style Warner Brothers cartoon art.
Yeah, I'm a sucker for the 70s, 80s kind of cartoon art that's on games. Like I think Burger Time is my favorite art on a cabinet. It's just so funny looking and weird, and like Food Fight also. Just this kind of like, you know, it belongs in a pizza place, you know? I love that art.
They had such great logos back then. None of this like, we have some fonts that are just the name of the game. Like they would get, you know, like crazy Roger Dean style artwork for Galaga, for Centipede. Right. It was like, hey, dude, we saw you do some Yes album covers, and we love that. So can you do that for our video game also?
Yeah, and that's part of the experience. It just I always try to emphasize this. Like, people are like, oh, yeah, I have a MAME cabinet. It's like, you don't get it, you know? It's like, the joystick is as important as the programming for these games.
The little art next to the joystick.
Here, let me inkjet print some sprites and just tape them on the cabinet. Woo, it's retro.
On the ground, climb up the ladder quickly, and then spin yourself around. Open the umbrella up and answer the phone. You can do it with a partner, you can do it all alone. Scale up the wall, just how high can you go? You'll surely break her heart if you get too slow.
But that happens too much, and I think, like, you know, actually having the experience of sitting and playing an Atari Star Wars machine is like mind blowing.
Oh, yeah,
it's like a roller coaster,
and that was great because
that's a giant. Control panel.
People would keep that machine up and running well into the 90s.
Yeah,
I you know, when I was in college, I would find places that still had Atari Star Wars. And I'm like, man, this game is like 15 years old. What's going on here? But it was awesome. Like, that game was popular enough that it merited, you know, then continuing to do upkeep on it and maintenance despite the fickleness of the vector.
That's a really good point. I remember that being in my college, student union. They had that alongside you know, the Phantom Menace pinball machine.
Oh, strange
cool.
enough. That's kind of like a sad state of evolution.
A real alpha omega, sort of.
I bet Jar Jar said some crazy stuff when you got multi-ball.
I always sign, whenever I play Star Wars, I always sign it Jar, and then I get the next score and do the next
one. Oh, nice. You've tainted that machine.
I know. It's great. It was a high school.
But yeah, show. I mean, the cabinet really, like, the evolution of the cabinet in arcades is really interesting because, you know, you talked a little bit about Pong. Mm-hmm. And before that, you had Computer Space, which was that funky plexiglass.
Have you guys ever played
thing.
One of those? I've seen them in
what,
a museum.
The Computer Space?
I've yeah, seen them, but space. Not playable.
They're so beautiful.
Yeah, I tried playing one, but it wasn't working.
Really?
Sad.
Oh,
but
man.
It's very, very cool.
And that machine, you know, is that if you guys, I'm sure people listening to this know, but that's the giant, what is it? Like, it's kind of like boat material. Like,
yeah, it's like fiberglass.
It's got those little like flex inside of it. Is that what you're talking about? Yeah.
I mean, it's made from the same material as motorcycle helmets, basically.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. With the same shininess. And it's just a big wad of space age.
Material. I mean, it totally looks like, you know, if you were watching the movie 2001 and they were in the Howard Johnson lobby. In space, they'd be like playing that.
Yeah, I think that's probably the coolest arcade cabinet from that era. And then there's also the Jaws knockoff game. And I think it's called Great White.
Shark? I think it was called Shark in Tiny Text, and then Jaws in huge text.
There is Shark Jaws,
but there's just Shark too.
But there's also one that's just it's a big molded shark.
Oh
and
wow!
It's, the mouth is open, and the screen is in the mouth. It's so amazing. I love it.
Yeah, I mean there was kind of an anything goes mentality for a while throughout basically through the 70s, and then. Cabinet format sort of standardized around.
Like Galaxian and Pac-Man, you put them next to each other and it's the same design and everything. Like Nintendo games too, you know, like the companies made their design and then all the games stacked up next to them, Dig Dug and Centipede. They look
but it's interesting because cabinet designs varied from country to country. So if you go to Namco's headquarters in Japan and play, you know, their original Pac-Man games, like those cabinets are really tiny compared to the ones we had here because, you know, the spaces were so much
smaller.
So
they're like the cabaret machines we had here. And we should mention that there's the cocktail type
of
games,
cabaret, like
full size, and cabaret is my favorite.
Those usually appeared for like quiz games and that sort of thing. I remember Professor Pac-Man being in one of those.
Oh, boy.
I feel like it was a more American thing to have the cabinet shaped like things because it was kind of fitting in with the style at the time where the bowling alley I went to that also had an arcade was shaped like a castle. It was called Camelot Lane. And it was in the shape of a castle, like these hokey roadside attractions.
It's amazing. Right.
They like wanted to be like more than just, you know, utilitarian. They wanted to offer some sort of novelty, and that was the Shark Jaws and whatever else, like the cabinets that were shaped like things. But yeah, the Japanese cabinets were much more
modest. Sea Wolf is like a periscope that you look into. Right. That's a 70s game.
But the great cabinets were always the ones that sort of broke from the mold, you know, going into the 80s, where you have things like the Tron arcade machine with its crazy, like weird shape and the funky controller you had.
And it has a black light in it with like a crazy, you know, Tronscape that you look into in the background, like kind of an optical illusion with a piece of plastic that warps it. Like that experience is part of the game. Mm-hmm. I've played that on Xbox Live and Discs of Tron, for instance, you know, giant environmental cab.
Right.
It's so depressing to play emulations of those.
Yeah, I mean, like I've played Spy Hunter on compilations and it's just not the same as having the steering wheel and the pedal to drive with. Like the pedal was totally useless. Like you didn't really need it, but it was part of the experience.
The gear shift was important, though.
Yeah, you were a spy. Mm-hmm. You were Peter Gunn, based on the music. I really miss that sort of era of funky cabinets. Now the only funky cabinets you get are things like DDR, which have to be massive behemoths. So that
there's also like the stupid 3D games you put over your head and stuff like that,
and all the Namco shooting games. They still make those where you climb inside of a boat or a jeep or whatever vehicle that you're in the game.
And even more gimmickier stuff like that. I mean, it's funny how this all just came back around because a lot of Japanese stuff is like that table flipping game.
Oh, that looks so cool! Yeah,
from Taito.
Oh yeah. They have one of those in Japantown here, right?
Oh, do they? Oh,
yeah. I just heard about it.
That's right.
I want to check it out.
They also have Rhythm Heaven.
Really?
Oh, the arcade version. I need to play that.
It's exactly the same as the Game Boy version, but with bigger buttons.
Huh. Yeah. And it's branded and everything?
It is a Rhythm Heaven machine.
Wow.
Exactly the same as the arcade.
I'm going there today.
There's games like Brick People, where it's, you know, it gives you like this pit full of plastic bricks, and you have to stack them up so the characters on screen climb up.
Yeah, I mean, to talk about control input, I mean, there was like a runaway innovation with that because Atari forced their employees to change the control input for every game. So that's where you got the trackball.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, where did the trackball come from?
Controller.
First game, Asteroids?
No, I was just reading about it.
Asteroids was like left, right, and thrust.
Oh, buttons,
The Missile Command, maybe. I don't know.
It's before Missile Command and Centipede, there was a trackball game. I don't know why it's slipping my mind right now.
Atari Football?
Yeah, football, that's it. Yeah, football was the first game.
Oh, yeah, that was, okay.
And it's a big black one. It's really fun.
I only saw the video of it being played.
You pinch your hands so hard.
Yeah, I avoided those.
Yeah, you can't do that in Centipede, though. You're fine with Centipede. They made it. That's just a cue ball in Centipede.
Well, also in Centipede, you're not rolling it as vigorously as you were in Atari Football. Mm-hmm. I mean, Atari Football, you're putting some real muscle into it. Like, that is a game that makes you sweat because it has that sort of... I don't know. I feel like they tried to capture the athleticism of an actual sport. So you have to really, really like roll the ball field. Fast to make your guy move.
I wonder if there was a bread pan to catch all the human skin that would fall off.
Ew.
No, but they.
I just got that image in my
brain.
That's
how they started their cloning system.
Oh, my God.
You're going to see little Bob Mackies running around the arcades.
The NSA was at work even back then.
Yep. Now, there's an urban legend.
Whenever I open a control panel, there's always something disgusting in it. And I remember when I got the centipede machine, I turned it over and it was all working and everything. It was just like caked in root beer.
Oh my God.
You know, or some like cola or something.
There was a mouse family having a nice dinner.
It was so sticky and it was covered in hair from that, from like maybe one or 10 spills. I don't know. But it worked perfectly. Like these games were made for that kind of.
And you had like artisanal rock candy when you were done, right?
Rat candy.
Sorry, I'm being really gross today. I don't know what's wrong with me.
My favorite control input innovation was the dog button on this game called Mousetrap, which is a maze game.
Oh, I played that, yeah.
It's really funny.
It's the only game with a dog button,
I think. It's the only game with a dog button.
Is it shaped like a bone, too?
No, it's just a green square with a dog on it.
Mm.
And you hit it, and your mouse turns into a dog. And Buckner and Garcia wrote a song about it called Mousetrap.
Yeah, there's nothing else to write a song about.
I also like the 720 controller. I don't know if you guys have ever played that.
It's their skate game. Kind of remember it.
It runs a bike chain. So it rotates around. Like, imagine you're not pushing it. You're actually rotating it in a circle. And under that, it drives a bike chain that drives an optical disc. And it's just this incredibly complex thing. And it's just so you can like go in the air and spin it around and your character spins kind of freely.
Huh.
People that are good at 720 are amazing to watch. Because they're like doing this thing with this controller and just letting it fly and it just spins and they catch it. Kind of like a spinner and, you know, and it's Tempest or something like that.
Huh.
It's more complex.
Weird. So, yeah, I feel like the 70s were kind of the sort of, you know, putting down the roots and just establishing some basics. And then around 1980 or so is when video games really, really started to take off. And that's kind of when, in my perception, the arcades began to really explode and become like a thing where people went and spent time. And, you know, video games became cool and you started seeing them in movies.
And Joysticks was made, Sam's favorite movie.
Exactly. Totally awesome video game.
Sam, I know you hate that movie, but I heard it's...
No, I like it a
lot. Oh, really? Okay, I heard it's pretty bad.
It's pretty much softcore porn with Ms. Pac-Man.
Yeah, it's like boobs and video games smashed together.
It's great.
In one package.
You can watch the entire thing on YouTube. Like, somebody's just...
No one cares about that copyright.
Yeah, it's like an hour and a half long YouTube video. Watch it. It's great. Good soundtrack, too. But you were saying, Jeremy.
Yeah, I mean, 1980 is when you see Centipede, Pac-Man, Rally X, Defender, Missile Command, Battlezone.
Like, 1 year.
That's 1 year.
Yeah.
Can you imagine if we had
to make
that much innovation in a year these days? Like, it would
make, I mean, most of those titles are from Atari, too. Like, Atari had Centipede, Asteroids, Battlezone, Missile Command. Like, that was 1 year.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, Pac-Man and Rally X were Namco, and Defender was Williams.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, everything else was Atari. I mean, they really just were totally, even all the way through the end of the 80s, it was still, you know, Atari games. A lot of the
and Williams and Stern were pinball makers, and Gottlieb even made a few games. And
yeah, I think they were Qbert, Gottlieb, right?
Yep, that was. Yeah,
hey guys, before we get carried away, let's not discount the amazing advances in not innovating that the current industry makes in 1 year. All right.
Totally.
That's true. There's a lot of open world games. It's coming soon.
Some of them first person.
So, I think the most beautiful game of that year, 1980, was Tempest, which was an early full color. I think it was the first full color XY vector game.
Vector game, yeah.
And it is just
It launched Jeff Minter's career.
Yep.
Somewhat.
It's great.
As far as it went.
It's featured in, have you guys ever seen the movie Night of the Comet?
Yeah, I love that movie.
Yeah, of course.
Cheerleaders fighting zombies?
The MacGuffin is a Tempest high score.
Okay, that's right.
Is that related to Night of the Condor?
No.
Oh, that's Day of the Condor.
Night of the Hunter.
If you enjoy Lollipop Chainsaw.
Night of the Comet.
I don't know why you would. But
yeah, the beauty of Tempest is just mind-blowing. That's another thing you can't emulate. If you run MAME, you're running a weird pixel sprite approximation of Vector. I don't even understand how that works.
Vector games just don't emulate well. Yeah. There needs to be like a special computer that where you can just emulate Vector games.
Yeah, when you open one of those up, it's kind of interesting because it's the TV tube, but then powering the TV tube is the game board. There's no TV per se. Like, you know, like the graphics are generated. And
it's
then,
directly drawing the graphic. Yeah,
yeah. It's so different, you know. Yeah. And those monitors, man, those are not going to be around much longer. You know, people repair them; they're not being made much, and hopefully they'll stick around.
Especially those tubes, yeah, tubes in general. But those, yeah,
it's sad.
I don't know. Technology finds a way. There are still Zelda gold cartridges that have working batteries.
I know. I've actually never had one that doesn't work.
All right. So, you know, 25 years later, we're still waiting for him to die.
Yeah, totally.
Hold and reset before you turn off the power. That's my advice.
Is that the secret?
That's the secret.
I was just reading today that Battlezone had the U.S. Army licensed Battlezone to make some kind of
the original America's Army.
Yes. Which they were supposedly going to use to train people. But I guess it was unreleased, and I've never seen a prototype of it or anything, but I'm going to look into that today.
I think it got fairly into production.
You've seen it? I haven't seen it, but
yeah, I've read a lot about it.
Okay.
I mean, I don't think it was ever supposed to be released in the traditional sense of, like, you know, wide distribution arcades. It was more like, you know.
Well, I mean, I just was wondering if it was at Fort Bragg or something, you know.
Right.
Probably. Yeah, perhaps.
So 1980.
There's a lot happening that year.
We haven't mentioned Donkey Kong yet.
We haven't, but that was 1981.
Oh, okay. There you go.
I mean, I don't know. Like, to me, 1980 is kind of this big divide in video games. I guess it helped that 1979, you had Galaxian, and all of a sudden color graphics were a thing.
Right.
And there was suddenly, you know, more powerful hardware running the games, and there was just more opportunity to express ideas. And I think also, you know, the sort of growing prevalence of home video game systems maybe lit a fire under arcade game makers. Like, they had to distinguish themselves. They had to make their game stand out. And the easiest way to do that was by having better graphics, by having more compelling gameplay than something on Atari 2600.
I wonder if they ever actually thought, like, it was any sort of threat necessarily, because I think, like, the original, the genesis of the home industry was kind of like, well, it's all based on arcade games. Now we can just sort of make everything based on those. And I wonder if, like, in those first few years, it was really like, oh, home games.
Well,
really
no, I don't think it was like, oh, whoa, they're going to eat our lunch, but more like, you know, we're making these games in the arcade and then they go home. And so, you know, we have to stay one step ahead of what's heading home. You don't think so?
I mean, I think it was just kind of natural. It was a natural course. I think many arcade game developers are just sort of in their own world. And
I think also console developers didn't have the luxury of just putting out new hardware where an arcade developer could just...
And yeah, a lot of those machines were supercomputers at the time. Like each machine, you know?
I don't mean to say there was not an element of it, because you do read stories about how, you know, the Atari consumer and arcade divisions were always at a certain kind of rivalry. Mm-hmm. And for sure, there's that element to it. But I think that's just like... the natural evolution of arcade technology and those type of computer boards were just like, you know, it was always going to be a few steps ahead of the home.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying, like, you know, arcade developers were sitting around sweating like, yes, 2600, that's a pretty amazing piece of kit. How are we going to compete with that? But it was more like,
yeah, I get it.
You know, just the sense that, you know, these older games were going home and they wanted to be one step ahead of that.
Yeah, the development was so different because at home, finally people started considering.
Clearly, they agree with me. Clearly.
People started making games like, you know, Adventure and Pitfall and stuff where you could just freely explore and take a lot of time doing it. But in the arcade, there was a mandate where you worked at Atari to make a game that people played for 2.5 minutes. Mm. You know, that's what they were designing games for.
Sure.
It's amazing that those games are so fun. And so
video games as a you know, a rock and roll single.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I mean, they wanted your quarter in 2.5 minutes, have you move on. I can't imagine how those games ended up actually being fun, because you'd think if that's what your boss is telling you to make, you'd make a pretty terrible game, but it's a lot of good games.
Yeah, I mean, back then, they didn't have really genres or rules in place
or
to say,
gigabytes of RAM.
Here's, things like that. Here's what we can't do. Here's, you know, here's what video games have to be. It was more like, let's just throw something at the wall and see what sticks. So you have video games where you have stacks of giant burger components and you're walking over top of them to make a hamburger while the ingredients are chasing you, trying to kill you. That's really weird.
Yes. You gotta
suspect a really weird idea.
You gotta suspect somebody's boss there was like, you know, we haven't broken into the burger shop market yet, and we need to get a game that we can put in Burger King's.
They're killing us with these ice cream games.
Well, you know, they probably looked at Pac-Man and were like, well, that started out with pizza, so
right.
What's pizza's natural predator? Oh, hamburgers.
I think this was in a lucky time before marketing where they weren't like, well, how do burgers track with the males 18 to 35? Do we need mayonnaise in this game?
Marketing was, oh, look what's popular. Let's do that.
Yeah.
But then it's like, then there went. When there's space for, you know, some sort of innovation, quote unquote, then yeah, that worked out pretty well.
Yeah, marketing then was saying, well, we want to be able to put Tapper into, you know, places where kids go, so let's make root beer Tapper.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, exactly.
I still played Budweiser Tapper as a kid.
Oh.
Speaking of amazing machines, that one has a beer holder, a cup holder on the side built into it, and then it has it has a tap for the controller, and then in the bottom it has a bar. I don't even know what you call it, the thing you rest your feet on at a bar, a brass bar attached to the bottom of a fake wood paneled machine.
Isn't that the little knee thing you pray on?
Yeah, totally. It's the same idea, you know? It's like to keep your dirty feet off the damn bar. I don't know, but they have that on all built in, so you get the full bar experience.
Hmm. Yeah, that's another cool example of, you know, building that sort of environmental thing. Mm-hmm. Not quite the huge shark mouth scale of things, but yeah.
It's good stuff.
Still pretty neat.
Mm-hmm.
And convenient. Why don't they all have cup holders? I don't.
Yeah, instead you'd get, you know, game systems like the NES where you'd put the cup on top and spill it. And
I go to
if the NES had a cup holder built in,
yeah,
it would have been so much more durable.
Somebody makes cup holders for pinball machines now, and you can just attach it to like the top of the legs. And the place here in town that has a bunch of pinball machines, Free Gold Watch, they have cup holders on every single.
I believe Pac-Man Battle Royale has cup holders on it.
There you go. Yeah. Booze and games.
Yeah.
Essential part of arcades. And smoking.
I'll drink to that.
Lots of smoking.
I don't think I've ever smoked and played an arcade game. I mean, I'm not a smoker, so.
Right.
I would like to try, though, because you sure look cool.
But yeah, the idea of drinking, I mean, that's, you know, the barcade that still exists where you don't have necessarily arcade games, but video games. I went to a couple of retro bars again when I was in Tokyo, and, you know, it's just you sit around, you play some video games, you drink, you do worse and worse at your video games as you drink more.
And yet, those are much different than the Western idea, which are larger scale and meant to really look like an old 80s arcade. Many of them do.
Right.
And it's just like, oh, let's go out and, you know, pretend what it was like in the early 80s. Where in Japan, it's just like a bar with a bunch of games lying around.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's no way to make money off of arcade games anymore. A quarter is not enough. I mean, you can guzzle quarters all night at your retro arcade,
but
it's really hard to get by. You have to come up with different ways to make money.
In Dave and Buster's books, I gave him his Pac-Man as like $1.25 or something. I don't know. Sure. Yeah,
is that how they do it?
Well, I mean, they have a card with points on it, okay. So you never know what you're spending unless you like do the math.
Oh, that's,
I mean, really,
evil.
If you look at inflation, 25 cents in 1980 was what, 75 cents now?
I was going to look that up. I was wondering, games, that sounds expensive.
What, 75 cents?
Yeah, you know, for.
Yeah, but I mean, that's what it cost back then. Like a quarter actually kind of meant something. And it's not, you know, I remember in the early 80s, like when I would get a quarter, I'd be like, yeah, I got some money here. I can really, you know, I could buy a soda. I can play a video game. I can
get some Lick-A-Maid.
Oh, yeah.
That was later.
So yeah, that means that like that makes it all the more interesting that they would put out these simple games that are supposed to take your quarter, but then people became really damn good at them and could play forever. And I think there was just kind of like, we have to make games that people can play for a long time, but not forever. And it's really interesting. I mean,
yeah, I mean, some
you can
games,
play Pac-Man till its completion, but that was never intended.
Right. Some games would just, you know, not even be subtle about it and would put something that would come in and try to kill you after.
Mm-hmm.
So many seconds, you know, like Crazy Otto in Berserk.
Yeah.
Yeah. He just comes in and he's like, oh, you spent too long on the screen, so it's time to die.
The humanoid.
Mm-hmm.
The ghost from
Spelunker.
If I could derail slightly, we should at least mention King of Kong and Chasing Ghosts, which are about guys obsessed with this period of games. As much as we are retro gamers, they are only retro gamers, it seems, like this the Twin Galaxies crowd. Have you seen Chasing Ghosts, anyone?
Yeah, I have not.
It's sort of like the dark, feel-bad alternative to King of Kong, because it sort of reveals how empty and joyless a lot of these people's lives are, that all they care about is this score in this game. I mean, I think King of Kong revealed that a little bit, as much as it was kind of stacked against Billy Mitchell, as big of a jerk as he was. But I recommend Chasing Ghosts as like the sort of more realistic, less fairy tale kind of take on the competitive gaming scene.
Chasing Ghosts is more about more people like Billy Mitchell.
Right, right. I mean,
but still in varying degrees of sadness.
Like, the title implies sadness, you know, chasing ghosts. So, I don't know.
Yeah,
for sure. It's recommended. It was on Netflix for a while.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the video game score obsession is the same as any other obsession. And, yeah, you know, if you let it take over your life, then that's sad.
But, yeah, and that, well, it also kind of took over, like, the media coverage of games. Even if, on, like, a local
After
scale.
After that guy died playing Berserk.
Yeah, on a local scale, it was just like, oh, games are the hot new thing, and here is the next world champion. It's really just, you know, state champion, maybe.
Yeah, I think like the Pac-Man kill screen is like a blessing, because you can play Defender for 72 hours, or like Hubert. Like, people that win, you know, high scores in these games now just have to like not pee for an hour.
Kill screen save lives.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, exactly.
They don't just hook up catheters.
I don't know what they do, man. I don't know how you marathon a game. I don't know how
this is
done.
Really awful.
I've watched
but
people do it.
I think you marinate.
I read, like, maybe 2005, there was a story about someone beating the Star Wars arcade game, which we're going to talk about, or getting the highest score ever, and there was a pee bucket mentioned. So there was a guy peeing while playing the game. I mean, you have to. I mean, what are you going to do?
Just while the Death Star is exploding.
I guess.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I guess there was a curtain around him or something. I don't know what happened, but I want to know. So if someone knows, tell us. How do you use the bathroom?
I mean, Sam, you joke about it, but, like, yeah, if there are those little moments of pause in a game, yeah, that's probably when you take your moments to...
Yeah, what's it? Is it
recalibrate
in Asteroids? I think there's a technique. I think it's called trolling. There's a technique that you do where you go into the corner of the screen and you can just shoot the. You leave one little asteroid and then you can shoot the UFO forever. So in that sense, you can go potty when you need to.
Pee buckets.
Marathon.
Pro, con?
I'm con.
I prefer Stadium Pal.
Did you guys have any high score experiences ever in the arcade? Or now? Are you good? What's your game, I guess, would be the answer to that.
Wow.
Really have a game, per se. I always just kind of have always played video games casually for the heck of it.
Yeah.
I still gotta get good at Goonies. Yeah. I gotta learn where all the diamonds and the special abilities are.
I know.
We're from the generation where games had endings.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We mostly went for that.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
we weren't trained to be high score getters.
In the arcade era, I was much too young to be able to compete with, like, college students for high scores. So I would just, you know, go and play, and when my quarter ran out, then I would go play a different game. The way that Atari intended.
Yeah, it's fun to learn a game. I have a friend who's been working on Robotron for a while. It's not like he's ever going to be, you know, a depressing competitor in it.
Yeah.
But, like, him, he plays Robotron a lot and has gotten really good at it, you know, and I really respect that.
Yeah. Especially with Robotron. Jesus.
Yeah, I know. Speaking brutal. Of games that just throw insane things at you eventually, but people overcome that stuff.
True. I mean, yeah.
It's amazing.
Was that the first twin stick shooter?
Possibly.
Possibly, yeah. It's sure a good one. Well, I guess, no, I'm Berserk. You walk around with one stick and shoot with the other.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
I guess so.
Yeah, that's right.
It's just really slow.
Yeah. It's kind of a methodical game.
Mm-hmm. Good sound chip, though.
Yeah. Yeah, all the was Robotron also Eugene Jarvis?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Like, his games had that really high speed element, and they always had these really kind of dense, detailed graphics. I mean, Defender, there's not a lot happening visually on screen, but, like,
it's,
I don't know,
striking, though.
It's, yeah, because it's so fast paced and there's just so much happening all the time, it just feels kind of like an overload. Like, your ship is flying around, you can move freely in any direction, you're shooting, there's ships swooping down to capture humans, it's happening off screen, and you still have to be aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that game,
have you guys
really
played Defender recently?
I haven't played it recently.
It's the most insane control panel. Everything's a button.
Yeah.
It's hard to control and figure out. And people that are good at it, it's amazing. But I'm like, you know, just give me an analog stick. I'll be great at Defender.
Yeah, there's a game called...
Asteroids 2 is like that.
Crap, I can't remember
Star Castle.
There's a game coming out for PS4 that is basically like the the next generation version of
Octodad?
No, not Octodad, alas. It's called like
that has some creative button inputs.
Rezogun, that's it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that game looks really cool.
Yeah. I played it at TGS. It's
lots of
fun.
Particles in that one.
Yes, a lot of particles. But, I mean, Defender had a lot of particles. Things would come together and coalesce.
The mutants.
Explode.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, it even has the mutants. Like, it captures humans and takes them to the top of the screen.
Okay, so this is really inspired.
It's totally a Defender game.
And of course, Defender had the hyperspace button. Right.
Right.
So. Oh, actually, sorry, that was Asteroids. Defender had some kind of
warp. It had, like, warp.
Space warp or something.
Yeah. And then the sequel was Stargate, which I've never played.
Which is pretty similar. Those games are, like, impenetrably hard to control for me.
Yeah, I didn't get very far into either one.
I love watching them. Defender's not a vector game, but it's drawn in those, like,
right, it has that style. Lines. I was really surprised when I discovered, oh, this is not a vector game.
It'd be cool to see somebody do a retroactive conversion of Defender into vector. Because vector can do stuff like that. I mean, Major Havoc, for instance, is a platformer in vector, and it's really cool.
Yeah, I guess the expense and uniqueness of vector games, the kind of persnicketiness, really kept that medium from being fully explored to its logical extent. Like, I would be curious to see what more vector games could have done than what they did. Like,
they're good
for
flight
shooters
sims and driving sims. Battlezone and Red Baron are just really, really cool early games that do 3D graphics. I mean, it wasn't until iRobot that anything did, you know, raster 3D graphics at all.
So. Yeah, true.
Yeah. Yeah, and the advent of polygons kind of made vector moot.
Yeah.
But I don't know, there was like a 5-year period that would have been really fallow for vector games if, you know,
there's some oddities. You know, I was at California Extreme playing a game a lot called Boxing Bugs, which is it was like Black Widow's like this too, but it's kind of a shooter. But you're shooting with twin sticks or something. But then they have these cutscenes that are drawn in vector, and it just looks crazy. You know, the crazy weird drawings of things.
What game is
math.
That?
Boxing Bugs.
Huh.
Yeah.
Never heard of that.
Look up that one. It's an amazing vector game. But there were a lot of experimental vector games. There's War of the Worlds. That's a really cool one.
Yeah, I guess maybe I just haven't seen a lot of vector games because
it was
only
so hard to
sort
maintain.
Of big ones that you know.
It's like Laserdisc games. They just they don't hold up as well as other games.
Well, they do get ported quite a bit.
Yeah. So, Sam, we're an hour into this podcast, and you haven't once mentioned Puppy Pong.
Oh, yeah, Puppy Pong.
I don't even know you anymore.
Or Dr. Pong.
Dr. Pong?
I don't actually know Dr. Pong.
Dr. Pong is just like Puppy Pong. Both were made to be put in doctor's offices, and Dr. Pong is just a more boring version. It doesn't have a puppy
I thought
on
the
it.
Cabinet was shaped like a doctor's head.
No, unfortunately it's not. But yeah, Puppy Pong, the Snoopy-inspired Pong that they couldn't license.
Mm-hmm.
Does Dr. Pong have a copay? It's like $20.
Do you guys remember games being in doctor's offices? That was a common thing.
I don't actually remember that. It was always highlights for kids.
They had Frogger at a dentist's office when I was younger. That's pretty cool. But that's what they made it for. They're like, oh, if they're going to buy Pong machines for the office, just make this little one.
I've heard stories like, oh, this dentist put a Wii in his office. Great.
Mm-hmm. Also, Dr. Pong, I think, was invented so you could wheel it up to somebody's bed on like a gurney.
Oh, yeah.
Could play. And there was other games like that. There's a Klax I've seen that's like that.
It's a precursor to the Starlight Foundation, which Nintendo had a partnership with, and they would produce these hospital-friendly Nintendo setups.
That's cool.
And wheel them into children's hospitals.
So what are your thoughts on video arcade hybrid games, specifically Baby Pac-Man and Granny and the Gators?
I love Baby Pac-Man. It's a terrible arcade game and a terrible pinball machine, but combined, I think it's really funny and really fun.
I remember
in that game, you collect, your Pac-Man maze, and it looks terrible. It looks like an off-model Pac-Man.
Yeah.
And then you go out, you know, the maze side, and you end up as a pinball, and you have to, like, build your power pellets.
That was the amazing thing about Pac-Man, Baby Pac-Man, is that the video game component of it, it didn't look like Pac-Man on Galaxian hardware. It looked like Pac-Man on, like, Space Invaders hardware. It's black and white and just looks like, I don't know, like an LCD screen or something. Maybe it is. I don't know. It's really, really primitive looking. I remember playing it at the time and just being like, what's wrong with this game?
As much as it's easy to make fun of, I think pinball manufacturers picked up on that because after maybe 90 or 89, there were all these mini games you played with that little LCD score screen. And they would also, sometimes have really good graphics. Well, good for, you know, the little colored lights, but still you could always have Arnold Schwarzenegger shooting at you from that.
There are a few few pinball machines that actually have a CRT monitor in them. And one I was playing the other day at one of the repair shops that works on my games, they had this great game, and it's called, I think, 10,000 BC, but it was basically, it was a dinosaur-themed pinball game.
Was it the Jack Black?
The early 80s. No, oh. it's really early, and it has a maze Pac-Man-style game that you get into, the ball locks, and then you have a joystick on the top of the machine, and you play a pretty good maze game, and then go back to playing a full pinball machine, so... Mm-hmm. That's less so recognized.
Pac-Man, baby Pac-Man done better, basically.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I mean, it's a full-size pinball machine, too. So.
I never actually saw Granny and the Gators.
I haven't either. I've seen a video of it.
That whole thing was also the conceit of Arcade 2000 games, which is like this... I forget who actually made it.
Was there one weird, like, Alien Invasion one?
Yeah.
Okay.
We've seen it.
The Pinball Museum, yeah. Right? Yeah, that's where I played it.
That's one of those. And that was just like a totally failed initiative.
What is it?
It's called the Arcade 2000 series. It's a bunch of different games, I think made by Williams. I'm not sure. But yeah, they tried. That was their great big plan to revitalize pinball once and for all. Didn't work. But yeah, it was a lot of that video integration sort of thing.
Yeah, like Attack from Mars or something like that.
Yeah, that's right.
There's a really cool Williams upright pinball machine. That's a pinball machine that uses mirrors. So you're playing the pinball in the background of, you know, you look into it like an arcade cabinet, you would put it next to your Robotron and Williams machines. And it's really amazing. And it has a stupid name. I'll come up with it in 10 minutes. I'm sure. Upright pinball. It's the way to go.
Upright pinball.
Mm-hmm.
Guess so.
Yeah. Speaking of baby Pac-Man, the weird licensing brouhaha that happened around Pac-Man has always been really fascinating to me because you have like the official Namco developed games. And then you have Midway, who bought the Pac-Man license for distribution in the U.S. and were like, let's just make a bunch of crappy Pac-Man games ourselves. So
And one really good one.
And one really good one. And except they didn't even make that themselves. They licensed it from some other people.
Also, at the time, there were maybe six Pac-Man designs. You don't know which one you were going to get. Right. I like the one that was sort of like oval shape with like little stocking feet. You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was weird.
That was like the original Pac-Man marquee art.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I had a t-shirt with that on it.
The blob, I love that Pac-Man. The blob form.
Yeah. He had like red and black eyes or something.
Yeah,
like that.
He had red eyes.
Wow. Scary.
Once the cartoon hit, everything was branded with those Pac people. And I think that's really cool. There's actually another Pac-Man pinball machine called Mr. and Mrs. Pac-Man, which is great. And you actually play a little maze game in that, but it's made out of, you know, just lights.
Weirdly enough, I think Namco picked up on the Hanna-Barbera cartoon designs because Pac-Land was that exactly. Like, he even had the little stupid hat with a fairy under it.
The little hat. Yeah. That's totally Hanna-Barbera.
The jaunty hat.
Because you can be naked, but if you have a hat.
Everything's fine. No pack genitals.
Yeah, and the ghosts didn't kill him. They just would like they would all fly to him and go.
Yeah,
and then he'd be sad and deflated until he had a power capsule. It was a weird cartoon, but yeah, it's interesting because Namco, when they do Pac-Man compilations and talk about Pac-Man, they talk about they talk about Pac-Man. They talk about Pac-and-Pal. They talk about Pac-Land.
Pac-Man Plus. No, they didn't
Super
do
Pac-Man. They didn't do Pac-Man Plus.
Super Pac-Man, that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah,
of.
Super Pac-Man. Yeah, they talk about those, the games they make, but they kind of just gloss over the Midway stuff. Even Miss Pac-Man tends to get short shrift.
Usually,
not always.
Yeah,
they've compiled it occasionally, but
right. It's like if we made the port, then yeah,
yeah. But I don't think that have they ever compiled like Pac-Man Plus and
I don't think you could even play Pac-Man Plus in anything.
No,
old arcade
you can't
machine.
Really. No. It's weird.
That my Pac-Man came with Plus in it. I got really attached to it. It's a really cool variation of Pac-Man, but a lot of people don't like it. But the ghosts have
got
little
Coke
flags
cans.
On their heads. Yeah, you get a martini.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
I hate Pac-Mania.
Soft drinks and hard drinks.
Pac-Mania, the weird 3D one.
Isometric. Anything isometric, I kind of hate.
Pac-Man's
except
growing
that was a Namco one. That was a
right,
Namco.
Right.
Yeah. So
that's canon.
That's canonical. Baby Pac-Man, on the other hand, is not. And then
Baby Pac-Man's the scrolling one.
Pac-Man Junior is the scrolling one.
Really,
which is really terrible. Mm-hmm. Like the scrolling field is not good. It's too complicated, too cumbersome. I don't think I've ever beaten a level of that game.
Yeah, it's too big.
Yeah, it is.
You just get bored.
Yeah,
it's like a job.
That's like Pac-Mania too.
I actually just played I went back home to Youngstown, Ohio, and I just played an upright Pac-Man, and I think it was one of the original ones or a really early one because the joystick isn't long. It's like really close to the base of the machine, so you can't get like a good grip on. You have to kind of like hold it with your palm facing down instead of facing outwards. I don't know. Did
so
you guys?
That could have been a modification, but I know in the cocktail machines, there's really little joysticks for
it. Right. The joystick was tiny. It was weird.
Also, Nintendo's games had that stubby joysticks too.
Yeah, Nintendo's games are Micro Switch joysticks. They're not Leaf joysticks. So to play Donkey Kong, you're actually clicking a Switch, which people don't really realize. There's a big difference between the smooth Pac-Man style joystick and the Micro Switch joystick, but Nintendo always used those, and they always get squeaky, and they feel just right.
Yeah.
They're really nice.
Yeah, sure.
Nintendo also made, and this is really getting into the weeds, but they also, their buttons are higher than other buttons.
Oh, yeah.
When you think of an arcade machine button, Nintendo's buttons were raised, you know, a good 3/4 of an inch off the board, and, like, people are obsessed. Like, those buttons are in short supply. Nobody's making them right now. They're really expensive. It's kind of funny.
Weird. Yeah.
I got a pocket full of quarters, and I'm headed to the arcade. I don't have a lot of money, but I'm bringing everything I made.
So, yeah, I kind of see the years between 1980 and, say, 1983 as the arcade's golden era. I arbitrarily draw the line at Dragon's Lair.
I like that.
I don't
Although Star Wars came out, you know, the same year as Dragon's Lair, so
right.
It's risky.
Right. Well, I'm basically saying 1983 is when Dragon's Lair came out, so that's the point at which everything changed.
Mm-hmm. Well,
like, you got Space Ace the next year, and, you know, it's all downhill from there.
But it was Morning in America, right?
It was. With a U. Morning with a U.
I feel like we could do a whole episode on Laserdisc games just because there were so many weird things that people were trying after Dragon's Lair.
Yep.
None of them worked.
But at the same time, like, I don't get Dragon's Lair. Like,
I don't either.
I get I get the nostalgia, for sure. I totally understand why it has historical significance, but I do not... I mean, I cannot comprehend why they continue to re-release it and why people continue to buy it.
It is strictly nostalgia. It's the same reason that you know, they keep doing Spelunker merchandising in Japan.
Mm-hmm. I can't,
like,
say...
It's not necessarily good, but people like it. They remember it.
And plus, if you buy it, you can always just watch it, and it's like one of the few pieces of Don Bluth animation that's not sickeningly cute.
Yeah.
You know, it actually has some kind of style to it.
Yeah, plus, but Daphne's really hot.
She did have visible nipples through her... through her sheer, like, dress.
No, it was, she's wearing, like, a black swimsuit underneath.
I'm thinking of Space Ace. There was some weird, like, weirdly sexual.
She's still really sexy.
She had, like, all of them. Yeah, she had, like, a diaphanous,
right,
like, nightgown, basically, but she was wearing a black swimsuit underneath.
Okay. Yeah, they all had some.
Well, animators are perverts. I think we've been over this.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder, really, if you're buying it because you're an animation aficionado or just because you had that nostalgia. I'm sure it's mostly people who just like, oh, I remember that game. Yeah, I'll plunk down up to $9 on it.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. All pinball art requires having nipples on it or big boobs or something.
Pinbot?
That's just like, that's part of pinball.
You know,
if it's a game about a bar fight, there's still a girl with big boobs on it.
Right.
But, like, arcade games never did that, really. They were content to have weird cartoons.
I think pinball was always, it never quite escaped the bar scene. It was always much more of like the sort of, you know, rowdy, drunken crowd. Whereas video games did eventually break free of that gravity and become these things for kids and families.
Yeah, that is
interesting. Don't get me wrong, Miss Pac-Man's pretty sexy.
She is. She's that kind of Rubenesque style. Mm-hmm.
And those chicks on the Ladybug machine are kind of hot, too. They have wings.
Oh, yeah. Hmm. I remember those. That's really weird, actually, that someone would anthropomorphize and sexualize a ladybug.
Yeah, the game is clearly about a damn ladybug and bugs.
She's just a little round.
Well, they didn't need to anthropomorphize the whole thing.
They could have had some Ann Getty's babies on that thing.
That's what it looks like. It does look like that.
Oh, dear.
Reminiscent.
So, any particular games from that sort of, you know, golden age that really stand out? 81, 82, 83?
Well, I mean, it's not a great game, but we talked about Pac-Land. Is that considered?
That was 84, sir.
That was 84. I thought it was 83.
Yep, nope,
damn
84.
It. Can we cut it off at 84?
Nope.
84. That's a problem because, like, I like so many from 84 onwards.
Yeah.
I like all the food games from that era. I like Burger Time. I like Root Beer Tapper, Budweiser Tapper. Food Fight is really great.
Well, in an issue of the now defunct 1UP magazine, I think Frank Cifaldi wrote an article about the creator of Pac-Man, and he was saying how the game was created with women in mind, with the idea of women being attracted to food.
They like snacking.
Was that true for every game that was food associated, or were they just hopping on?
I don't think so. Burger Time doesn't strike me as like, the ladies are going to love this.
They love walking on meat.
There's a sausage chasing them. That's going to make them really happy.
But Sam is right. There were a lot of food-focused games. I guess maybe because food was around the arcade game. I don't know.
And that it kind of explains Weird Al Yankovic.
That's true.
Rose to popularity at the same time, and he always sings about food. It means something, as he says, as he shapes his mashed potatoes into the shape of my Diablo.
I have a side story. I was listening to the song Stand by REM. My girlfriend was there. She's like, this is a Weird Al song. And I was like, no, it's not. And she pulled it up for me on YouTube. I'm like, this is the perfect Weird Al song. It's called Spam. And that's all Spam. That's all it's about. Yeah. So, yeah.
It's pretty much.
I love it.
I wonder if maybe like food was easier to draw, perhaps.
That too, yeah.
Also because it is very universal, it sort of transcends cultural barriers. Aside from, you know, like the occasional oddity where you'd see like a Japanese melon in something and you might be like, well, what is that? But
it's a grapefruit.
Or they always drew peaches that looked like butts and I never got that.
Right. Food is, you know, as items in video games, food is power-ups. Like everyone knows what food is. Everyone knows what an apple is or a grape.
But don't eat a key.
No, don't eat a key or a Galaxian. Those things will give you indigestion like you would.
Speaking of things, eating things, I was playing Sinistar at a friend's house last night, and I think that's a pretty remarkable game. It has a great sound chip in it, and Sinistar is the scariest character from that era.
Sure.
He screams at you. He goes, "Rawr!" And then he tells you he's going to eat you, and that to be beware because he lives. It's a good one.
It's true.
That has a 49-way joystick in it, and that's really strange. You don't notice it because it just feels like a joystick. We're all used to joysticks, but you can minutely change the way your little triangle shaped, you know?
Yeah, why 49? Why not 50?
I don't know why they call it that, but I actually looked at it for the first time, and it has like this like, it's just bizarre. It's like this crazy crossed rubber band, and it has like these two sensors, and it's just nuts. It doesn't look like anything you'd imagine.
Hmm.
Innovation, man.
Meanwhile, Pokemon XY... is exciting because you can finally walk at a diagonal.
Oh my god!
You but click still, into a diagonal.
It's still all grid based. No,
it's digital diagonal.
Yes.
Wow.
Well, you can also use the analog pad, but it's still digital diagonal.
Of course. Yeah.
You know, Jeremy, your notes did also mention the Journey game.
Mm-hmm. I love Journey,
which I was always really fascinated by when I first heard of it. It was like Ralph Baer, I believe, had developed this primitive digital camera for it. That's why there's black and white heads of the Journey guys in it. And, you know, it was going to be a camera that would be mounted in the cabinet, I guess, so you could take your picture of them.
Yep.
And I guess in the testing, people were pulling down their pants and showing their neck.
Yep.
Since time immemorial.
Yep.
Yep.
I mean, it was basically that. Xbox Live before there was Xbox Live.
Yeah. It still came with a cassette deck in it, though.
Yeah. So
it had you got deck, that.
Yeah. The Victory concert. Played to,
but I mean, odds are if you're in an arcade, you're already listening to Journey in the background,
right?
With like Rick Springfield and REO Speedwagon and Styx.
It also had versions of the Journey songs in that game.
Yeah, I mean, the arcade scene in Tron, it's got Journey playing in the background.
Oh, nice.
So it just seems kind of recursive, needlessly recursive.
Mm-hmm. And the game did have chiptune versions of the music, and
I'm specifically a connoisseur of maze games. I like that genre. I like starting with Pac-Man and going forward. I really like Ladybug. I really like, as I mentioned, Mousetrap. And
what's your opinion of Lock and Chase?
Lock and Chase, is that the one with the paintbrush?
No, that's
Amidar.
Robbers.
Oh, no, Amidar or something. It's
Make Tracks.
Crush Roller?
Yes, Crush Roller.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, Lock and Chase is the Cops and Robbers themed one.
Okay.
With the guy who looks like Pac-Man, but he's...
And there was also Keystone Cops.
That. Sounds great.
I don't remember the difference between Lock and Chase and Keystone Cops.
Keystone Cops is not a maze chase.
No. Have you guys played Blueprint?
No.
That was a great early 80s game with a kind of a maze setup. But what you're doing is you're collecting parts of a giant machine, and it has like boots and a big horn on top. You don't really know what it's going to do. And I won't spoil it for you.
All right.
Does it make kicks a farting sound? Is what it does. Yeah, it's just this stupid like hobbling machine you put together.
Nice.
So smart. I love that game.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one.
I feel like
they have it at California Extremes.
The Xbox, the indie game Monaco is like the next gen of Pac-Man, multiplayer co-op, stealth-based Pac-Man.
Yeah.
Really?
I don't know if you've played it. It's really cool.
Yeah, I've been watching Marty play it at work, but I've never actually played it.
Is it more next gen than Pac-Man DX?
Yes. I don't know how you measure that, but
I mean there's like, you know, physical quantifiable element of next gen.
It has more graphics, so yes.
Oh, okay.
There are more graphics.
Okay. I don't know, man. Pac-Man DX has a lot of graphics.
Mm. There are a lot of tiles.
When you've got like 200 ghosts chasing you, that's a lot of graphics.
That is true, but they're all the same graphic.
But they're very angry.
They are.
I'm just going to keep on throwing out games. Have you guys seen Satan's Hollow? It's about Satan.
That's where I live.
It's an interesting shooter.
I believe in America it was called Hercule's Hollow.
It was definitely called Satan's Hollow.
I get it.
And it's awesome. Thanks. And it has Satan on the side.
That was my Dragon Ball joke for the episode.
It. Yeah.
Yeah. I was always fond of Zaxxon, even though at the time I didn't understand
Bongo,
it.
Of course.
right? I never liked Congo Bongo, actually. But
that's probably more of a Donkey Kong sequel than Donkey Kong Jr.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we should talk about the story behind that. But I just want to say, like, at the time, Zaxxon totally bewildered me because I did not understand inverted flight controls.
Yeah.
So totally. I remember me and my uncle put like a dollar's worth of quarters into that game, trying to figure out how to make it fly. And finally, we were just
plus
like,
plus, it's isometric, so it's really confusing
this
already.
Broken. Like, this game is broken.
It's wired upside down.
We cannot play this game. Like, we couldn't get past the first wall by, you know, deliberately. We got past it one time, but we just couldn't.
If I ever get a Zaxxon machine, I'll wire it the other way so you can play it the
right way. No. Eventually, my family got a ColecoVision.
Screw my wall
because
again.
They were cheap. Because, you know, fire sale.
And then you
got to
get rid of video games. The controller upside down.
No, then I played it enough that I was like, okay, I get it. It's weird, but I get it.
I had that experience with Star Fox. I remember being mystified by the down is up and up is down.
I think you could change that, though, in the option screen.
You can.
Yeah, okay.
I think it just defaulted, right?
Yeah. Well, also, we brought up Donkey Kong Jr. This was Nintendo's last, I guess, this is around the time they got out, because their last games were, what, Super Punch-Out and Arm Wrestling in 85 for the arcade?
Yeah.
Well, they had the play choice through the 90s.
So. Yeah, but right. those weren't unique arcade games. They actually did have a unique version of Super Mario Brothers for the arcade.
I played that, and it blew my damn mind.
Versus.
It's like...
Oh, Super Mario Brothers. Yeah,
it's pretty much the same game, but they tweak little bits of it. It's
so cool.
In some ways, it's more like the second loop through Super
they
Mario
did
Brothers.
Also, they did R-Type in, like, 1991.
What?
Yeah, Nintendo... You can go to Disneyland.
They distributed
they R-type
it in America.
Game.
I see.
Yeah.
And it's, like, Super Nintendo-level R-Type graphics, and it... In a Donkey Kong shaped contour Nintendo
true.
Cabinet.
Yeah.
Wacky.
It's really cool.
They could not quite let go of that.
I did want to say, though, I hate Donkey Kong Jr. so much.
It's so fun.
I can't play
good.
It. I can't play it. And it feels like such a weird step. I mean, it felt like they were experimenting for the sake of experimentation, but I like even the first stage just like baffling to me.
Well, you know,
but Donkey Kong 94 improves on that by letting you do everything in Donkey Kong Jr., but with better controls.
Donkey Kong 3 rules too.
Yeah, so I went through the games not too long ago and realized that, you know, the original Donkey Kong is a game about sort of horizontal traversal and using vertical movements to evade hazards, basically.
Yeah.
Whereas Donkey Kong Jr. is more about vertical traversal and then making small adjustments horizontally to avoid danger.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like they were just turning it on its side. But they didn't do that consistently.
Yeah.
So there's like the Spark level where you're pretty much just running along and jumping. And
Donkey
Kong Jr. himself is not, he's not designed for that kind of movement.
No, like, he's not.
His shape
he's designed
is
for
weird.
Animation, I'd
like, I love the cabinet art. I love that what the characters look like.
Yeah.
But the
love
game
that
itself.
Mario's evil in the
game.
Yeah,
and there are two Marios in the beginning. Was that Luigi or just like Mario?
No, it's just Mario and other Mario.
Okay. I think it's only in the arcade game you see the cutscene. But
Mario and Mario
flipping
Prime.
The villain Ooh. Was really smart. That was just a great touch.
I mean, a lot of great ideas. They just weren't executed very well. I don't know if anyone wants to defend Donkey Kong Jr., please do. I want to hear a defense of it.
I've heard it defended as just like being one of the hardest games. And so it's a desirable game to kind of get good at because once you understand it, it's just like Donkey Kong. There's a high barrier of entry. You get really good at it. It's interesting.
Donkey Kong was really accessible and Donkey Kong Jr. was more like expert mode. And, you know,
his jump arc was so weird. It was just like, I can never get it down.
Yeah. The way
it's
he
hard.
Like kind of stretches out, his hitbox changes.
Yeah.
It's really hard to platform in that game because it's
and
hard
when he jumps,
to predict
he goes, boing.
That's
really strange.
He looks like a wiener dog.
But back to Congo Bongo.
Yeah, so this is something that I've written about a few times, but every time I mention it, people are like, I don't know, it's like no one reads the articles or something. Damn it, people, pay attention to me.
I read that article that you wrote, and I thought it was great. Well, we talked about it at work.
And, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty around this, but I don't think we've ever talked about it on Returnaut, so we should.
Oh, right, okay.
Which is that... Donkey Kong was designed by Nintendo. Like, you know, Shigeru Miyamoto came up with the concepts for the game. He did a lot of the artwork for it.
He said, do this.
But yeah, the actual programming in the game apparently was contracted out to a company called Ikegami Tsushinki.
Do we know, basically,
an electronics company, and they have a long history in Japan, and they've, you know, they did some contract work on video games. They were good with programming and circuitry. And, you know, that was back when people made discrete boards for arcade games. So it made sense to contract that work out to people who could actually create the boards for you.
So did Nintendo not have a place to develop games like that before they moved on after the lawsuit and everything? Oh. Sorry to jump the gun here. I just was curious.
Well,
I don't know if they manufactured.
It's all speculation, so who knows? But I mean, this is kind of based on translated court documents and
Got
stuff.
It.
But anyway, basically, they contracted with Ikegami Tsushinki to make X number of Donkey Kong arcade boards. And then Donkey Kong was really successful. So instead of going back to the contractors and saying, hey, can you make more of these for us? They just made more themselves. And then when it came time to make a sequel, they reversed engineered the boards and made Donkey Kong Jr. And obviously, Ikegami Tsutsunki was not very happy about that and took Nintendo to court for breach of contract. So that is probably why you never see Donkey Kong Arcade compiled in Nintendo games.
And as you
see
mentioned,
the NES version, but not the arcade game.
In the article, that there's evidence they left their like a little signature and a thing about like, oh, it's cool that you discovered this.
And
the
call us. Code. We want to give you a job. Yeah.
Yeah. Weird. But then they went on, of course, to work for Sega, doing the same type of work, and they did Congo Bongo.
Right, which is basically like a screw you Nintendo.
It's an isometric Sega.
Such an Nintendo. It's such a Donkey Kong.
Starting the rivalry between Sega and Nintendo.
Right. But they also did Zaxxon, which was run on the same hardware as Congo Bongo, has that same sort of isometric art style. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's a much better game than Congo Bongo. Congo Bongo, it's never really clicked with me.
I think it's a pretty game. I really like that it's a little cube world and everything's kind of very angular.
Yeah.
And
no, I love the art style.
It's the same with Crystal Castle as well. Yeah. It's like Pac-Man meets Donkey Kong.
I love the art style, but the goals and objectives and hazards aren't as clear as they are in Donkey Kong. Donkey Kong works because it's just like everything's right there. It makes sense. You run, you jump. You avoid the fireballs, you hit things with hammers, like it's obvious.
Actually,
whereas Congo Bongo is a lot more, it's a little more abstract.
Mm-hmm. Those games like Congo Bongo and Crystal Castles remind me of those old toys. I don't even know if there's a term for it. It was a toy that you set up and it would just like perpetually go, like there'd be like dogs moving down a chute, or like it would be just be all these like chutes and ladders and things, and like they would just go automatically down. Do you know what I'm talking about, anybody?
Just like a Jacob's ladder,
like a Rube Goldberg machine, but it
sort of
resets.
But like late in the 90s they made them with Sonic the Hedgehog where it'd be like Sonic going down this path and then he would just go up to the top again and it would keep going down. It was very strange.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, they don't make them anymore, but they're making them up until Sonic the Hedgehog,
and they're just little plastic like ant farm type setup
sort of. Yeah, but they remind me of like what Congo Bongo looks like, and just a character that keeps moving down.
You'll have to dig up some images of that for us to link in the blog.
Some YouTubes.
It's very interesting.
There are some lawsuits, other lawsuits around the time, which were notable, like the Jungle King lawsuit.
Well, the Nintendo Ikegami Tsutsunki lawsuit never actually came to a settlement, like a, you know, an official court settlement. They basically settled outside of court for undisclosed terms. And, you know, because it was a private settlement, like, no one knows exactly what they said. But
and you were saying that we probably can't
that was in
play
the late
Donkey
80s.
Kong because of that
right.
lawsuit.
I think that there's probably...
That's like, why they added a damn Pi level to their stupid NES port instead of releasing the damn
They
game.
Hacked the ROM instead of, you know...
And they can't figure out
game.
How to ask how high can you get. What the hell?
Yeah, and likewise, I don't think they've ever compiled the arcade version of Donkey Kong Jr. You never see Nintendo arcade games compiled, period.
No.
But I think, you know, a lot of that is because of the, like, just sort of a cascading effect from Donkey Kong. They can't republish Donkey Kong, apparently. Hmm. So, you know, that's like the one everyone would want. So it'd be really kind of weird and conspicuous if you got, you know,
there's
arcade Punch-Out.
Most of those are vertical
and
monitors.
Space Radar.
Punch-Out has two monitors. Like, it would be hard to do that, but the DS would be awesome for that.
Yeah.
Yep.
You could turn it on the side even for the vertical monitor.
Yeah. You mentioned Donkey Kong 3, which is an interesting game.
Yeah, it's a shooter.
What year was that? 83?
80.
I said it's 83.
I think it's. Was it 83? I thought it was 84.
It could
no.
be.
It'd
oh, no.
Be a little simple for 84.
Super Mario or Mario Brothers was 84. Yeah.
And Popeye was that after
was like
83?
82.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Donkey Kong 3 is interesting because it's basically. A remake of Space Phoenix, a previous. Oh,
is it similar to Space Phoenix? I've only seen that cabinet. I've never actually played.
Yeah,
it.
I mean, if That's you look awesome. At the way it plays, it's very very similar. Like the way you have kind of like things descending from above, and you have like the caterpillar shooting at you.
Yeah,
like
was the Space Phoenix named
Space
Stanley?
It was not.
Nintendo never lets go of ideas, even if they're failed.
Nope.
They hold on to them.
Yep.
That's a good point. Maybe that was Yamauchi's legacy. Like
Star Fox Command was basically Star Fox 2 without some of its wackiness. You know. Mm-hmm.
I know these two screened LCD systems are going to come back someday.
Well, someday they're going to help us rise to heaven.
But I was talking about some lawsuits, and
thought
there's a couple interesting ones.
Yeah, why don't we round out the episode with talk of lawsuits?
Yes, well, there's some interesting ones, though. Jungle King was a really cool a game that was based on Tarzan, and there was a Tarzan yell in it.
Didn't it start out as Jungle Hunt?
It started out as Jungle King, and it became Jungle Hunt. They reissued it after is it Arthur Conan? No, what's his name?
Johnny Weissmuller.
I was thinking Sherlock Holmes, but He also did Conan. Well, Burroughs?
Edgar Rice Burroughs.
Yeah, his estate, I think, discovered this kind of obscure Taito game and pulled the plug on it.
Was like the sheet music for Tarzan's yell in the novel or something?
Well, that's the thing. Like, that's what they got mad about was the yell. So they took out
An invention of the movies, not the books.
And put him in a pith hat and then sent him back out as Jungle Hunt. I think it's pretty funny. And
now he's civilized.
There was also the Stern, the really important lawsuit where Stern, I think, licensed Konami's Scramble here, which we haven't talked about yet. That's the precursor to Gradius, I guess they were saying, Retronauts. Why is it Gradius? But
either one.
Yeah. That game.
Britain say Gradius.
Yes. Another company just made Scramble and just put it out. They called it Scramble. Hmm. They reverse engineered the board. They just put it out. But I think it was Stern that licensed it here. But they had registered the game as a audiovisual work and not as a work of literature, which all data had been registered as before.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
and by
cool.
that quirk, they sued the bootlegger and won. And that became precedent.
Oh.
Hmm.
So that's
very important.
So video games are no longer literature.
Right. They're not art or literature.
It explains a lot about the writing I see in video games these days.
So I thought that was a pretty neat.
I've never heard about that one. That's an interesting lawsuit.
Yeah. Hmm.
And of course, there was a Universal Donkey Kong lawsuit, but mm-hmm. I think that was later in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was early on and it was resolved later in the 80s.
Yeah, that was the King Kong challenge.
Donkey Kong had a lot of lawsuits.
And there was so much, I mean, Donkey Kong fever, if I may say that. I know there was Pac-Man fever, but Donkey Kong was like, sort of like the linchpin for every home console. Like, we need Donkey mm-hmm. Kong for our system.
We can make it better.
Yeah. Again, we're dredging up old Retronauts.
That's true.
Earlier this
really?
This season.
That's right.
No, that's okay. I mean, okay. it is really interesting how pivotal Donkey Kong was in like 1983.
Mm-hmm.
Like Coleco, Atari, Nintendo, like several other companies, I think. Did a television have Donkey Kong?
No.
Like, there was this race to have the perfect Donkey Kong.
Yeah. Like, the Atari computers did.
Right.
And nobody did it. Donkey Kong machine. Come to my house and play.
Nintendo's looked best and had the actual proper layout for the board.
It just stretched a little bit, though.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it was squashed down, but it still, missed all the little interstitials and was missing a stage. Whereas the Coleco Atom version.
How hard would it have been to put in how high can you get? I don't get that.
They cut out
the damn game order.
There was no cutscene in the Donkey Kong Jr. one, like I said, in the NES version, because you would see Mario and Mario pushing Donkey Kong's cage off the screen. Yeah. But that wasn't the NES version. It wasn't
right,
as far
but the
as
Coleco
I can
Atom version had that.
Okay.
Because it had the luxurious space provided by cassette tape.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to watch, a loading screen, and then there's a cutscene, then load a little more, and there's your level. But yeah, that did have the stages. But at the same time, it didn't look quite as good, and the Coleco version was missing one level of the Donkey Kong opening stage. So that's a shame. But it did have the Cement Factory. So there was really no definitive home version of Donkey Kong. But nevertheless, that was the game that everyone sort of hung their system on.
Yeah. Pac-Man was old by 1983.
It was, yeah. I mean, Space Invaders was, forget that, that's like 5 years old. Right? Donkey Kong was the hotness. And he had, a cartoon. He might have had a cartoon before Pac-Man, now that I think about it. It was kind of based on Donkey Kong Jr.
Yeah, I remember the Donkey Kong.
I think the Super
Kid. It still followed Mario.
It did. There was Donkey Kong and Donkey Kong Jr. cartoon, right? Donkey Kong Jr. hooked up with like some greaser kid or something like that, right?
Cuber cartoon takes place in like a 50s high school greaser setup.
There's
a cool rock and roll theme song.
Well, there's the enemies in Cubert kind of have that like greaser style slick, especially. He's
Coily.
Got the shades. Ugh, wrong way. Yeah.
That game has a unique component in it, a little hammer that knocks, and it's the same hammer that's in a pinball machine that gives you a free game.
Hmm.
But you don't get a free game.
I bet Gottlieb had a lot of those just hanging around the office.
Yeah, totally.
Pinball hammers.
It's exactly right?
Yeah.
They have to put these things together with the parts they have.
Yeah, so I think we kind of hit everything we wanted to hit, or everything I wanted to hit.
I mean, if we had a pizza here, then we could talk about games for another day, I'm sure.
Right.
Fun and pizza.
I've got a croissant. It's not quite the same thing. I don't know. Like, I have a lot of fond memories of playing video games back then, and
I think it's interesting that we don't, but we still are interested.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing about these games is they are so simple and so sort of immediate. Like, they put their ideas forward, and they're very accessible that they have a sort of universal timeless appeal. Which isn't necessarily the case for games made later. Like, some games made later work really well, but, you know, I think, you know, a really casual gamer could get into something like Pac-Man or Centipede more easily than they
or
could.
Or a drunk gamer.
Right.
Yeah.
Then they
you
could something like a, you know, now. Like an NES game.
Yeah.
Because, you know, even though they were simpler and more primitive, that's kind of part of the appeal. There's a universal.
Oh, that's another weird cabinet that Nintendo did later. They did a Dr. Mario dedicated cabinet.
Did they? But was it a standalone game?
Like yeah, it's a standalone
like
game.
A separate version from the NES version? I remember playing the NES version, but it has a cabinet.
Package, an art package, and it has like the Dr. Mario with like a bunch of pills on the side. It's so cool looking.
Yeah, I mean, they continued doing arcade stuff into the 90s, but you know, in terms of actually designing a game specifically for the arcade, I really think that the Super Mario Brothers
arm wrestling probably rounded
revision
it out.
Game.
Yeah, I think that was it for them.
That's so. A good game too, arm wrestling.
Awesome. Sorry to interrupt seeing that. No, no, no. I mean, arm wrestling was great because it was kind of, you know, like the sequel to Punch-Out, basically. It had a lot of the same characters. Did it come before Punch-Out?
No, it was definitely after Punch-Out.
Okay. Really great graphics.
Really easy to break those controls because you have to hit them as hard as possible.
Like,
quack, 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 quack. I don't know how they even planned that.
When did they make their love tester machine?
The 70s or 60s, probably 60s, 70s.
Okay, because I remember seeing that in the arcades, you know, around the same time as arm wrestling.
Are you talking about a love tester in the arcades or the little one that you hold as the little panel? Because I've only seen that one. There's like this little one you have in your house that looks like a Famicom and has two controllers.
No, they had one that was in the arcade.
Oh, okay.
They actually used those for Scientology tests down at the Powell Station where I got off.
So that's where they all went.
Test your love and your Thetan level at the same time.
You know, all those old Nintendo toys are in Animal Crossing. And throughout July, there's a little fireworks festival and you could go in and you get the little love tester. You could get the Ultra Hand and the Ultra Machine.
Could you get Duck Hunt?
No, you cannot. You can't get any damn games anymore in Animal Crossing. It's a bummer.
But Duck Hunt was it? Well, we'll talk about that next.
Oh, yeah. I see the toy. Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, that I would say is pretty much everything we need to say this time about the golden age of the arcade.
Mm-hmm. My favorite is Star Wars. I don't know if I got that out there. I think that's the best arcade game ever made. I know it's a bold statement. We'll talk about that more later.
Yeah, I guess the one I would play the most would be, and therefore my favorite would be Galaga.
Traditional.
I guess so. It's really well designed. Really
what about
good.
You guys? What are your picks?
Sam's going to hate me, but I like Dig Dug. Both enemies.
I'll revisit Dig Dug.
I mean, it was really cartoony and I was sort of attracted to that, you know?
The art is awesome.
I just liked how the art in the cabinet was like that same Nintendo style, even though it wasn't a Nintendo game, like really bold colors and
I like
thick
that
lines.
The level is indicated by the number of flowers.
That's
top
cool
of the
too.
Stage. Just little details like that are a lot of fun.
And I like how the music plays while you walk. I think it's so funny.
Yep. Yeah.
I mean, he's basically got musical shoes. He's like Philippe from Akewood.
Yeah, they're like LA Lights, but they play jams. We know it's Dragon's Lair, Ray.
I really like Bomb Jack and Zevius.
Mighty okay. Bomb Jack?
Was Bomb Jack, that was like 84, 85, wasn't it?
Yep, but you said arcade games.
I meant from the Golden Age, but Zevius definitely
you're
falls
a Zevius
into
fan,
that.
Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I love Zevius also.
That's a really cool cabinet. It has like a full art package of like crazy metal spaceship that you look into. It's
right.
Really cool.
Yeah, I remember the first time I saw that in the arcades, I was like, wow, this game looks so cool. And you've got two layers of attacks. I can't wrap my head around this.
It was like a 4.5 second loop of chip tunes for the sound.
Oh, yeah.
But what an amazing 4.5 seconds. All right, well, Sam, thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Bob, Ray, thanks as usual.
About the stuff.
Mm-hmm. That's it for episode 13 of Retronauts. As usual, you can find us on the internet at retronauts.com, retronauts.tumblr.com, Facebook/Retronauts, Twitter, Retronauts.
Twitch.
Am I forgetting something? Twitch TV, Retronauts, YouTube, Retronauts.
I'm going to start streaming more. It would have already happened by now, but you're welcome.
And on iTunes, we are Retronauts, where you must go and click 5 stars because we're amazing. Unless, of course, you're angry about politics, in which case, whatever. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with more talk of arcade games from before you were born. So please look forward to it.
Hear you say life's taking you nowhere.
Angel,
come little baby, look at that sky, life's begun. Nights are warm and the days are young.